Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 6, Episode 7, entitled The Broken Man. I don't know if you want to play the name game right up front, but there are several broken men in this show. You know, the Hound being a major one.
Sure.
He's kind of one of the big momentous things that happens in this episode is the return of the Hound.
Yeah, still not completely unbroken. He's got a bit of a limp.
Yeah.
Might have lost a half step.
He was pretty close to broken. He's about as broken as you can get before you die.
Yeah.
So, pretty broken.
He's just a big fucker and he's tough to kill. What do you expect?
He is. You know, Jaime's a broken man. He's got one hand. Bronn points that out. And, of course, Theon. Theon may be the opposite extreme of the Hound. The Hound was physically broken. Theon is mentally and physically broken.
I was going to say.
He's all of the above. It's unfortunate, but who knows? And maybe also the Starks as a house. I don't know. The broken man of Sean Bean.
Yeah.
Maybe he counts.
A lot of Northerners of the opinion that the Starks are done for. They're down and out.
Yeah. Seems like it. I don't know. I like this episode a lot. I think it was good.
I do too. I mean, I felt like we had a nice, fun, instant take. The one thing I was kind of, well, I'm not surprised because there was so much other awesome stuff to talk about, but we didn't really talk about Theon.
No, we didn't.
And his sister, which is what the full cast is for, so we'll get there in good time. Pressing news, it looks like everyone's letting me off the hook. They agree with our analysis of, I don't know if you care to play that sound clip again for the people that are not spoiler podcast listeners.
Nope. Basically, you made a bet that said, if
Benjen Stark shows up, but I qualified it before the end of season 5. Mm-hmm. And that was the key thing.
Yeah.
Now, probably in spirit, if someone asked me that day, I would have doubled down and been like, ever. But I didn't.
Right.
So, and it looks like the vast majority of the listeners, I don't think anyone said I should do it. There was a couple joking, like, you should just write DI. Mm-hmm. Since you were kind of like, you'd respect the spirit, but not the letter.
Yeah.
Letter of the dick. But no, that's not going to happen. I hope people didn't sign up just to see me put red lipstick on my forehead. If so, keep watching lunches. We'll do something ridiculous before too long.
Probably. Yeah.
Okay. What else do we want to talk? Oh, do we want to talk about the other little gravedigger thing we got going on?
Sure, I guess so. This is an appropriate time.
I mean, we're about ready to get right into it, but, so, this season we talked about it being the death of mildly interesting, which is the catchphrase I used to use when Jim was unsullied, to essentially say, I can't give any more information.
Unsullied meaning I didn't have spoilers. There's a lot of terminology we throw around.
I think people can get that, though, right?
Maybe
all right.
Not.
You're trying to save me email. I get it.
Yeah.
But yeah, to show that you weren't spoiled, and it's something I used to say to try to as a neutral response to like, well, I can't really theorize.
And for people who don't listen to the spoiler cast, I've since joined you on the spoiler cast.
Sure.
Because we are, for the most part, beyond the books.
Sure. So we had our buddy Eric whip us up a T-shirt that kind of commemorates the death of mildly interesting. And he came up with a really nice design that has Sandor Clegane with a shovel burying it with a tombstone, burying, you know, the dates it was active and all that. And it's pretty attractive T-shirt.
With the epitaph, spoiler Morghulis,
yes.
Which I particularly like.
All spoilers must die. But yep. So we've been marketing this on the spoiler podcast, and now that the Hound is out of the grave, we can offer it to everybody. So if you've been wanting some Bald Move merch, you can go to our shop at baldmove.com/shop. And check it out. It's now available for everybody. But we hid it. We hid it behind a custom URL because we didn't want to spoil anybody. That's how much we care.
Yeah. Now you can go to gravedigger.baldmove.com to get it, or you can just go to the store. It'll be on there.
Yeah.
Very soon.
And then finally, on a personal note, I had literally hundreds of people sending positive vibes and energy for my father's surgery tomorrow. And I just want to say how much that meant to me. And you can tell it means a lot because I'm stilted and awkward talking about it.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
That's
because it's too real.
It's too real. But I was touched. Mm-hmm. I was touched. That was very nice of all of you. So thank you.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering The Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga-sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
All right. Recap time?
Recap time.
We start off with what is a rather cheery scene in the world of Game of Thrones. Like a surprisingly, it almost doesn't even feel like Game of Thrones type scene, where the guy from Deadwood is overseeing the construction of a building. There are people practically singing and dancing and just having a great time.
Ian McShane is kind of Ian McShaning, a little bit more of a positive spin on his, but still recognizably an Ian McShane performance.
Right, I mean, the Hound's out there chopping wood, and he's revealed as the Hound, kind of at the end of this, going right into the intro, which actually has Riverrun in it now, which was kind of cool to see.
I thought so, too. I thought the reveal was great, just the fact that you established all these guys groaning under this timber, and it's taken four men, and then this Hound comes up, and he's just one-handed it, even with a limp.
He goes commando.
He's full, he's Arnold, and... The physicality of, is it Rory? I forget this guy's name that plays the Hound. But the physicality of his performance, because he is in real life a big fucker. Mm-hmm. Because I was just like audibly saying, like, man, look at this guy chopping wood. Like, he is really going at it. And then Ian McShane's like, I've never seen a man swing an axe like that. It's cool. It's cool. Like, I mean, the Hound is this force of nature, and it's going to be fun to see him unleashed.
Yeah,
I mean, it sucks for him personally, because...
I don't care. He's a fictional character. I want to see him be badass. That's what he does.
Sure, sure. there's a very small part of me that when I read the books and I saw that he is with these brothers and sisters in the show, that and he had gotten a measure of peace, I'm like, huh, if that's how it ends, it wouldn't be a bad coda.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, Clegane Bowl. So
right,
you know,
and you can't let anybody have a happy ending in Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah, that doesn't seem to be the arc of the story.
Not at all.
I also like the fact that the guy's kind of teasing him unwittingly, saying it must have been a monster that took you down.
Mm-hmm.
Nope, it was a woman. And did you think the Hound played that as like an additional annoyance? Or just the fact that he doesn't like this guy digging into his past, or...
Oh, I think it was both. Yeah. I think he, you know, he's a private person, and also, you know, he probably doesn't like getting bested by a woman. So anyway, this guy from Deadwood feeds his fly. I didn't bother to learn his name, because he's dead by the end of the episode.
Septon Maribald. I'll help you out, though.
Okay. Baldy Maribald.
Baldy McMaribald?
Yeah. He feeds his flock. And he kind of talks with the Hound for a bit about how he survived and what he's meant to do. And we learn, you know, kind of how the Hound survived. They found him out there. He was basically dead. He coughed, scared the shit out of this guy.
I nearly shit myself. That's so
right?
good.
And then they brought him in and over the course of a while, nursed him back to health.
Yeah.
And it looked like he was going to die several more times.
It's funny because Ian McShane posted what could be conceived of as a spoiler in an interview before the season, once he said, my job is to bring a somewhat beloved character back to life. People gave him a bunch of shit for it, and he kind of soured, and he started getting surly with the fans. Like, it's tits and dragons, man. Grow up. And number one, that's classic Ian McShane. Two, I think this is like a one episode and done.
Yeah.
Like, whereas I think people thought that this was going to be, like, he was going to be an ongoing character for at least the rest of the season, but, like, it... And now knowing everything about how this went down, I think it's super funny, his reaction. Like,
right.
You know, that that I don't think he's ever worked on anything this big before. Like Deadwood was never this big.
No, of course not.
Yes, Game of Thrones didn't get canceled in the middle of it. So like, he just had no idea, and he's a cranky old dude, and he doesn't give a shit. And this is, I did one episode. I wore a robe with a fucking 7-pointed star. What do you want from me, fanboys?
And you get this information within the first 15 seconds of the episode.
I think it'd be rough. I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm not a spoiler phobe. Like, it's kind of a bummer if you get spoiled right before you're about to watch something, but I don't think it's the big... Really, spoilers only ruin things if you got mediocre works. Like, if
okay.
And there's also... There's obviously, like, super twists, like Sixth Sense.
Sure.
Nobody wants to get spoiled for stuff like that. But for the most part, I kind of roll with it. But I know some people are, like, super adverse to spoilers and it really ruins their day. So I'm sure if you're just reading an Entertainment Weekly and you're kind of familiar with the show and he says that how many people are dead, that I mean, maybe you thought he was talking about John and that spoil, I mean, who knows, right? Who the hell knows? But I thought it was super funny.
Well, we find out that he's basically a deist. He doesn't really like attribute a specific god to all of these things that are happening, to you know, this overarching kind of thing that he feels is out there.
Right.
Definitely more of a deist than a strict adherent to any religion, mm-hmm, or any particular god. And he talks about, you know, what the Hound is meant to do, what Sandor Clegane is meant to do. And he's trying to say, what he says later on to his flock, which when he tells the story about how he was a terrible guy and he came back from it and, mm-hmm, now he's just trying to do some good. He's trying to instill those ideas in the Hound. And I think throughout the course of this episode, it seems to be working.
Yeah.
It's at least getting him thinking, and he's not a thinking man for the most part.
Yeah, like he's a lot more thoughtful. Like even as he's like, well, if you're right, why haven't the gods punished me? And the Septon said, they have.
Right.
And like the Hound started doing the math on that. And like, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah.
How much more can they punish you without actually killing you?
Sure. I mean, you could follow that train of thought back to like, what did I do as a young boy that the gods wanted to push my face on the brazier for?
Right.
But sure, you can tell that the gears have started grinding in there, and he's like, hey, this guy's got a point.
Yeah.
And maybe it's not too late for me to be good. It turns out, and a spoiler for his life, that yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is too late. You're not destined for a life of peace and harmony.
Definitely not. So we move over to the High Septon telling Margaery basically that she needs to get pregnant to further their work.
Yep.
And says that she also needs to teach Olenna the new way, or she's going to be in trouble.
Now, I thought there was some really interesting stuff on multiple watches of this. The fact that he's urging her to return to her teenage son's marriage bed, that's an interesting... Because I don't know exactly what she's trying to do here, but there's a lot of interesting possibilities. Like, it could be that she is, by being pious, that she's turning her king against the faith, because now that she's down with the mother and the...
She's not DTF.
Now she's down with the mother, the crone, and the maiden, she's not DTF. And also, I thought it was interesting that after he told her that she needs to start boning her husband and also subtly threatened her grandmother, he put his hand right on her thigh, which she, you know, kind of noticed. Do we think that his Lightbringer is becoming inflamed? What is there?
Jesus.
You know, or are we going to find out that he is like as corrupt and venal as we kind of in our dark hearts suspect him of being?
Oh, I think he's corrupt. I don't know that he's like a sexual predator.
Why the hand on the thigh? I mean, and her reaction to that's a universal sign for creep.
Well,
unwanted bad touch.
Yes, but this is a handsy guy. Like this is one of those touchy feely kind of guys. Like I don't know if
you go with the Jerry Sandusky defense. That's what we're going with. He's just a handsy guy.
No,
you might brush his hand against your thigh. That's just him.
Seen it in other episodes. And
yeah, sure.
Like this is a pattern for him. And it's not particularly applied to women. It's not applied to anyone in particular. It seems to just be how he is. I don't know. Certainly, like in today's modern society, it's inappropriate, right? Like, that's not how you want to be touching someone, like, regardless of how you feel about it.
And whatever, modern day, old times. I'm just saying that the way it was filmed and presented seems to be we should take notice of it.
I think so. And it's also Deadwood guy is he touches Sandor at one point, and Sandor kind of recoils a little bit. Obviously, Sandor just doesn't like being touched as a human being. But I wonder if there's any kind of parallel there between these two men of the faith getting a little handsy. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit is Margaery's plan, like what it could be. Because later on in this next scene, she goes and talks with her grandmother, and she puts on this big show of being godly in front of Olna, or whatever her name is. But she tells Elena to go home and gives her this sketch of a rose to let her know that she's got a plan. Whatever her plan is, now, here's the question. Is she creating this plan whole cloth, or is she kind of adapting and using the High Septon's plan against him? Because, like, she went out, apparently, and brought Tommen to him, right? And really, like, secured that piece of the puzzle for the High Septon. And I think she's obviously got a plan here. I don't think she gives that rose to her grandmother and says leave. I think whatever her plan is might cause serious trouble in King's Landing.
Yes, we've got some pretty interesting
theories.
She
wants her out of there. And I don't know if it's just to, you know, because she's worried that the High Septon's going to get a hold of her.
Yeah, no, there could be whatever she's doing might be big trouble for King's Landing, and she wants her grandma safe and out. Maybe it ended up being the death of her.
It could be.
But no, we got a couple of cool theories in the feedback section that we can get to, but I just feel like that,
grasping at straws.
That it's the small folk lover, it's too late to change. Okay, that's the crux of it. I want to develop that a little bit more, because I feel like that's a big part of what's going on here, is that maybe things are going to go bad for King's Landing, but it might go bad for King's Landing because Margaery is trying to wrest control of the people away from the High Septon, and there's going to be a lot of bloodshed. But it's going to be one of those things like a French Revolution style, where if you're wearing a fine dress or you're wearing a seven-sided, like she's just going to lead this populist revolt.
It's kind of what it feels like, yeah.
And that's the thing, like, I got from Septa Unella, who is the Faith of the Seven Nun that I'm quite taken with now, and the High Septon. They both kind of realize her performance is just that. Or they suspect it, but they don't have any tool with which to, like, you know, they're trying to catch her in some kind of trip-up, and they won't let her. You know, she's free to go, but she's not going, and she's she's got no privacy, and she doesn't mind, and she's not having sex with her. Like, they get all this as fishy, but what do you do? And at this point, like I mentioned in the podcast, I think it's already too late. If you suspect treachery, you've got to either let her hang herself, because if you preemptively do something to her, the people are going to go fucking nuts.
Yeah.
They already love Margaery, the fake version of Margaery that they got in previous seasons, where she's going around feeding them, doing all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And now she turned the tide with her husband, the king, and they're wedded to the faith. And, like, I feel like the High Septon is in a pickle.
Yeah, and I wonder if he even realizes it yet.
I think he sees the danger, but he doesn't quite have all the angles figured out. And again,
maybe he thinks he can navigate it.
And that goes more to the point that I think that him and Margaery are essentially doing the Littlefinger plan, where maybe they don't even have... Because someone pointed out in a feedback last week that I don't think made the cut because there's so much of it. But someone pointed out that it's very unlikely the High Septon tried to engineer his rise to power, because until Cersei came and elevated him to his position, he was just a barefoot beggar priest running a soup kitchen. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a lousy plan if you want to be the most powerful person in King's Landing.
Sure.
Now, you know, once he got into power, power corrupts. Like, maybe there is a dark side to him that's come back out. Maybe this is too much temptation for him to bear, especially with Margaery living with him now. But I thought that was interesting, that if I'm betting on someone pulling a Littlefinger game off, that's essentially been what Margaery's doing. Like, she is adept at being all things to every person, whereas the High Septon's got the one thing that he can do. Anything, he swerves out of that lane and he's fucked. He loses all of his power. I think that's interesting. That if I'm going to bet on someone playing the rungs of chaos, the ladder of chaos game, I'm going to bet on Margaery.
Yeah.
Big.
And you think back to the High Septon telling her this story about, or was it Tommen that he told the story about him being a cobbler too? I forget. It was one of them. But you can see, like, how much he said, oh, this was all fake. And he even gets caught in his own story, like, telling falsehoods.
Sure.
And Marjorie in this episode is like, oh, well, when I was going to see the beggars and feeding them and clothing them, I was doing it out of self-interest. Mm-hmm. I was faking this sort of concern for them. Whereas now, what does he think she's doing? Faking her religious conversion here?
Right.
I mean, it should be obvious to him that she's capable of this.
No, and that's the... Yeah, but she's also doing that trick where she's assassinating her former character to build credence with the one she's building now. But again, what's
she's
the high
saying
step
all the right
gonna
things.
Do? What's he going to do?
Yeah. The other thing she's doing that I think is really smart is she is... And I think this is part of her plan. She cooked this up while she was in the dungeons.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's purposely trying to alienate everyone from Cersei. I think I think it was her that kind of convinced Tommen to get him out of the Kingsguard and send him away.
Yeah.
You know, everyone that Cersei has around her is now crumbling, and I think some of that is due to Marjorie.
Sure.
I think she's playing both sides of this.
Yeah, no, totally, because it could have been Marjorie's plan to be like, hey, you know, you need to get your uncle. Like, we suspected Uncle Kevin getting involved with that, but it could have very well been Marjorie saying, you know, I love your family so much, it would be a terrible shame if they got, you know, he defied the blah, blah, blah. You could see how it goes.
Yeah.
And I'm just so worried about your uncle, I can't possibly go to bed with you. there's not a lot of deft political maneuvering when it comes to Tommen.
No, it doesn't really need to be.
Did we get to the scene where she gives her grandmother the note?
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting as I was watching that. I remember a scene where Lady Olenna is talking to, I think, Tyrion, and they're talking about the Tyrells and how, like, their house sigil is a flower and their words are growing strong and how it's such a pale shadow of, like, winter is coming or hear me roar or we do not sow. And those are such strong. But I thought it was interesting how this might be one of the most, this flower... And the implication, still growing strong, that might be, in a certain way, one of the most badass sigils and words of Westeros right now?
Yeah, because it has a certain type of falsehood to it, right? Like you see the flowery, beautiful part of it, but what's underneath it? It's the thorns, right?
Yeah. I thought that was nice, a little callback to, like, if you're remembering Lady Olenna fretting about her house appearing weak and they're actually strong, whereas the Starks... And Lannisters have been essentially getting their ass kicked up and down Westeros more or less throughout the various seasons. And the Greyjoys, you want to throw them in too. All the ones she cited as canonical examples of fearsome words are getting beat. And the unassuming Rose is drawing blood with her thorns. It's pretty good. Pretty good. And they don't even... Yeah. It's very subtle. You can miss it and not... It's not required to enjoy it, but I really like what they did there.
And speaking of subtlety, I think... You know, rather than writing out the words, hey, grandma, I got a plan, yo, I'm faking it all on the paper, she just draws a rose.
Sure.
Says everything she needs to say with that.
Yep.
And Elena's smart enough to get it. So I really love her. She's amazing.
I would have liked it more if Olenna had gotten, like, really cold with Marjorie there, because I felt like as soon as she passed the note, there was such a change in her demeanor. And I thought to Septa Unella, but then again, what is she going to do? Try to snatch the note that she didn't see pass out of her hand? Like, Unella knew something happened, but didn't know what.
Right.
But I don't know. Maybe I'm paying too much attention to her, because, again, I'm quite taken with her. By the way, someone emailed me that the actress that plays her, Hannah Waddingham, is kind of a looker.
Really?
I was not steered wrong.
Impossible
by my
to tell
instincts.
In this show.
Well, do you know, I had a sense. A sense.
Okay.
So, but no, I think she's given a hell of a performance, and I liked all that. But I would have liked it if she had been maintained a facade, you know, essentially. And now, I don't know, the double Ds are probably like, ah, if we do that, are people going to get it? Because already a surprising amount of people are confused about what the meaning of the rose is, which I think it's kind of like plain reading.
Right. Trust me. That's what it means.
But I also like how I think Marjorie, even though she's doing this like kind of hammy performance within a performance, she had a really strong moment where after she passed the note to her grandmother and she left, right before she turned to the Septa and said, "Shall we pray?" She visibly like had to get control of herself because that was a very painful thing.
Yeah,
you know, the just essentially let go of the lifeline, like. it was she was very emotional, and she mastered it, and I thought that was a nice performance.
Yeah, it was good.
By Natalie.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain. Featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations, while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
So we go over to John, who is having a little bit of trouble convincing the wildlings to attack Winterfell with him. And Tormund ends up convincing them by saying, John died for us, and if we're not cowards, we should do the same. And also, you know, the giant helps a little.
Yep, the giant
stands up and says, no.
He's got instincts here, and they respect him. You know, I feel like the way you read that is, seems like you're skeptical, but I thought the scene was great because...
Oh, yeah, everything, but, like, I don't know why the giant stands up and says snow. I mean, clearly he's giving his support.
Sure.
But, like, it was a little funny to me.
I liked it. I thought so many shows struggle with this, having characters wrestle with genuine dilemmas where there are no good options, and they tend to either just belabor the point or... make one character the straw man and the other one just beats the shit out of them. And I thought both sides had great points, but ultimately the decision they arrived at made sense knowing what we know about the wildlings and their culture and the way they view things and their sense of tribalism and the fact that they kind of identified John as one of their own, which is something that they've laid back all the way back with Ygritte. Ygritte. I thought it was great. It is one of the many really awesome scenes between people. And even John, like, I acknowledge this is a raw deal. This sucks for you guys. This isn't what I wanted. This isn't what you wanted. And this is not something that you got into with your eyes open. But the Boltons don't give a shit.
Right.
So if you want to survive, and the fact that these wildlings, like, they've got this pride, and there's, you know, hundreds of generations and dozens of tribes, and they could all be snuffed out like they didn't even exist. You can tell what what an offense that would be. I liked it. I liked it a lot.
I do too, and especially when paired with these other scenes, you can see that John has the right idea. He's just unable to convince anyone or really express it well, and people at his side whom he needs come to his aid every time. I mean, Tormund here is coming to his aid. He wouldn't have been able to convince these guys without Tormund saying, look, he died for us. We need to do the same.
Well, and I think it's interesting if you think back at John and how his father, Ned, I think he's a lot alike Ned. And that Ned, you know, he was the second son and he was thrust into this position of power. But by the time we see Ned in season one of Game of Thrones, he is the Lord.
Yeah.
But from the time his father and his brother died, every noble in the North turned to him and bent the knee and supported him and was fully behind him in whatever he did. So he was able to grow into that role of the Lord naturally. Whereas John has been the bastard who's kind of been despised and gave up his, you know, gave up all his rights, what meager ones they had to go through the wall, where he was seen as this outsider and, you know, has gotten his balls busted for day one and is picked on. Like, he has not had any of those advantages. So it's like, I think it's interesting to see, like, what would Ned do in this situation? I think it's a lot like what John is struggling with.
Yeah.
And, you know, none of the, like, very few of the Northern Lords want to throw their weight behind them, and for good reason. That's the other brilliant thing about, I didn't think the Northern Lords, the ones refusing John, were assholes.
No.
Like, I thought what they said made a lot of sense, which we'll probably get to later, but it's very tricky to play that, to have discussions and disagreements with characters and not make one of them seem stupid. And
yeah.
Game of Thrones, I think, is nailing it.
Yeah, I agree. So we go over to Cersei talking to Olenna, and she tries to convince her not to leave the city and to help her instead, because they both have children who need help, or, you know, grandchildren in this case. But Olenna doesn't go for it, instead calling Cersei stupid and truly vile. She's also really happy that Cersei's lost, which I can't fault her.
She's
telling it like it is. It's amazing.
This is devastating to the point that I was nervous that Cersei was going to fucking lose it and just sick Gregor on him.
Yeah.
Like, I guess the mountain is looming behind her this entire conversation.
Uh-huh.
And Lady Olenna doesn't give a fuck.
Nope. That's what, like, I love about
it. I wonder if you're the worst person I've ever met. That was such...
It's hard to tell because, you know, memory fades, but you remember the truly vile.
Well, and the things, like, I remember the way you smirked at me when my grandson and daughter were dragged off to the cells. So great.
Yeah.
And Cersei tries to play the, look, I know you love your granddaughter, and we can trust in that mutual love, and she's having none of it.
No.
You know, you've lost, and that's the thing, like, you have nothing. Your brother with his army is gone. Your son's not listening to you. The people hate you. The rest of your family has turned their back on you. All you have is this fucking zombie.
Yep.
And if you want it to crack my skull, I guess. But you're still lost. It's not going to change the fact that you've lost.
Right.
Has Cersei lost? What has she got up her sleeves?
I think she has. I mean, the only chance she has at this point is to convince Tommen.
Is this
that she is right about these things?
I mean, is this the season that she goes down?
It could be.
Like, it's so funny because we've been talking about how, you know, this is Game of Thrones and truly memorable characters could die, which is why my blood pressure spiked when Arya gets stabbed in the end there.
Uh-huh.
But there's two seasons left and they're half season at that. The people, I mean, there's going to be a lot of people dying before this is over.
Yeah.
And it feels like maybe Cersei's coming to the end of her rope.
I could see her within three episodes being dead. I mean, sure. If you get a trial by combat here within the next... two episodes.
If it goes badly for her, or even if it goes well, if it goes badly for her, she's dead. If it goes well for her, what are the people going to think?
Yeah,
I mean, are they going to accept that as justice, or are they going to be like, this is bullshit?
I don't know. I mean, even if she wins the trial by combat and the people are okay with it, she's still got to deal with Margaery.
And she still doesn't have her army. She doesn't have Jaime. She still doesn't have her son, potentially.
No. Yeah. It's bad for her all around. I mean, I agree with Olenna. She has lost.
Yeah, and Cersei's super pissed. Like, I thought Lyanna did a good job of playing that clenched jaw, just kind of furious, cold anger. But I don't see her play. I don't see her play.
I mean, even if she does somehow wrest control back from the High Septon and Margaery and all that, she certainly is at a low point. Maybe she's not down and out, but she's certainly down right now, as far as she's ever been.
Sure.
So we go back. Actually, we go over to Jaime marching his troops to River Run, and we get a pretty epic scene of him marching a lot of troops, 8,000 of them.
By the way, I went and looked at that scene that I talked about in the instant cast where Tywin's butchering that deer, and Jaime is wearing essentially the same armor.
Oh, he is?
The difference is he was wearing long hair, Jaime. Flock of Seagulls, Jaime, which is not as good as short-haired Caesar-cut Jaime, in my opinion. So maybe, and also, he's kind of dark, and his father is just brutally busting his balls the entire scene.
He wasn't nearly as bad.
It wasn't as majestic. So, like, I do feel like I'm seeing Jaime for the first time in this armor, even though I didn't. So,
you know what's not majestic?
What's not?
The siege that the Freys have set up.
Oh, God.
It's pitiful, and Bronn points it out.
Everything about them is pitiful. They're wearing, they're wearing, like, what do you call those toboggan hats? They're wearing toboggan hats and sacks of potatoes on their body.
Right, the things that the peasants in Monty Python Holy Grail are wearing.
Yes, and they're just as shit covered. They're just as shit covered.
Right.
Like, you should have known, you should have stood down to Jaime Lannister when he rode up and he wasn't covered in shit, Frey. Yeah. Like, you could have saved yourself the taste of gold in your mouth had you just immediately yielded to the guy that had less shit on him.
So Jaime and Bronn are looking on as the Freys try to threaten Edmure in order to get the Blackfish to surrender. He doesn't budge, so Jaime rolls up and strong arms these guys and takes command of the siege. Strong backhands these guys.
Yeah.
Lays
the 24-carat pimp hand down on
the
mouthier of the two Freys. The dumber. There's one Frey I automatically think is smarter, because he's the one that kind of like, no, seriously, you don't want any part of this.
Yeah.
And the dumber one said, no, I do. So
when the guy with the metal hand starts talking about slapping people, I back up.
Yeah, sure.
I step out of range a bit.
And even if you wanted to fight them, he's got 8,000 men that have, like, real armor. They're not wearing essentially crusted shit, and that's your only resistance to blunt force trauma. He's got, like, real awesome-looking armor and 8,000 guys with the same behind him. Like,
The experience to actually fight a battle here. I mean, he knows what's up, and he's using okay.
Really easy slit in the throat of a pregnant woman and, you know, a concerned mother and a bunch of drunken lords who've been disarmed. Mm-hmm. Not so hard when you're dealing with the likes of Jaime and the Blackfish. Or not so easy,
When does Bronn wise up to Jaime's false promises here?
I don't, because that's the thing. I thought it was interesting when he says a Lannister always pays. Don't fucking say it. I thought that was interesting because he's like, I've essentially played this game with the Lannisters, and I parlayed myself to where I am now. And now he's offering to make me second in command of his arm. I kind of think that his ambition is such that he can't, like he understands the legitimacy of the offer and how this could go well for him, but it's like, you know, he's a slave to his own ambition.
Yeah.
He maybe should have cashed out with Lawless back at the castle, the Stokeworth castle.
It feels like it. I mean, the promise that got him to go to Dorne has gone unfulfilled as of yet, right?
Well, I think Jaime just keeps doubling down on it.
Right. That's like the same as unfulfilled. Like,
I mean, your castle, it's the castle walls just got 10 foot taller.
Right.
And the girl's even more. She was a Vegas 8. Now she's a Bravosi 10.
Oh.
You know, it's like, yeah, I think he keeps on sweetening the pot. And it's vexing to Bronn because he can't say no.
Right.
He wants more.
Yeah. Yeah. I hope it doesn't end badly for Bronn.
I hope so, too.
You know, he's a sellsword and a cutthroat guy, but I like him.
Bronn's the perfect anti-hero.
Yeah.
And he is, like, he added so much. Again, I noticed in the threads there's a lot of book fans that were unhappy with, especially maybe how things went with the Hound, and, like, it maybe wasn't as arty as it was in the books. But I feel like anything that the show lacks as far as eloquence between the Blackfish and Jaime, it made up for in the presence of Bronn riding up there to punctuate Jaime's statements with, if we'd have been hostile, we'd have come and fucked you in the ass. It's, It's good stuff.
What do you mean lacking in eloquence with Jamie and the Blackfish?
I didn't go back and reread the scenes because if I was going to play, like, you know, if I was going to do a compare and contrast, okay. I would have done, like, Sept and Maribold talking about the Hound from the books. But I didn't go back and read these passages. I remember them and how kind of epic it was, him confronting the incompetent Freys and then, you know, the very competent Blackfish. And that's a lot of the stuff is drawn from the books. It wouldn't surprise me if it was a little bit not as awesome and if there wasn't so much banter, but you add Braun and you add the physical set and I thought it really, really worked. It didn't.
Yeah.
I don't think it was, you know, poor second cousin to the books at all, but a lot of people disagreed with me.
Right. And obviously I haven't read the books, but I do agree with you that the visuals, like seeing this stuff.
The River Run is incredible.
Extraordinary. It's impressive.
Yeah.
On a scale that you don't see in television.
I mean, that's the what's so awesome about the like the Blu-rays for Game of Thrones is all the behind-the-scenes details. And I'm like already licking my chops to see like the construction story and like something. Because I know they're going to point out all the different fucking things they did to make it awesome. And
sure.
Yeah. It's going to be righteous.
Let's go back to John. He's trying to convince the child ruler, Lady Mormont of Bear Island, to support him with troops. Both he and Sansa fail miserably, but luckily Davos is there to save the day. Unfortunately, we find out that House Mormont, even though they're pledging all their fighting men, only has 62 of them.
They're as strong as 10 mainlanders, though.
So it's 620.
John's like, fuck you, I've got a giant. He's legit stronger than 10 men.
That's
like,
true.
Okay, 1-1, come in here. Who's your best dude? Let's arm wrestle. Right. Oh, your arm got snapped off. I guess you're not as strong as 10 men then, huh? what did you think about my theory about why didn't he lead with Longclaw? And I did misspeak, because obviously Longclaw does not have a wolf head. It's supposed to be an ivory bear. But the whole reason...
That's not true in the books. I was reading around on Reddit that when Gior gave him the sword, or when the thing got burnt down, the hilt and the bottom part of it, whatever that thing, the end cap is.
Oh, is that
true? Hilt got melted. Yeah, and so
Gior found it. Good job to you.
Reddit did. Gior found the sword and was like, well, this is fucked, and the handle was kind of busted up. So they recast it with the lion head on it. Or not the lion head, the wolf head on it.
Okay, I thought it was just an ivory bear that looked enough like a wolf that it works good because he's got ghost.
No,
so
they
actually remade it. Okay, so
I don't know. I forget how it went down in the show, because I was, you know, seasons 1 through 3. I was a casual
watcher. That's the kind
of
thing I would have gone back and researched if I had another day. But right. We're in shotgun mode here, so.
Cool. I don't know, like, if he whips that out with the wolf head on it, do they even
know it? Yeah, that's where my theory kind of falls apart. And some people are like, well, maybe they would have wanted it back, and I'm like, I don't know, because I feel like the Mormons are the kind of people that if our father gave, or, you know, uncle in this case, gave you the sword, then you should keep the sword. John's the kind of guy that, like, you know, Ned had Dawn in his hands, one of the most badass swords in the Seven Kingdoms. He returned it to the Danes. Like, I feel like if they asked him for it, John would have given it back to him. Although, maybe he'd say, look, I have more need of it for now. We got White Walkers to fight. After the war, assuming we all live, I'll give it back then.
What if he came back like offering it as a gift, and they saw his generosity and decided to help him, but let him keep it because Georg gave it to him?
Yeah, I mean, we're arguing like a reality moot point, but I wish they'd acknowledge the fact. I mean, they talked about all this history, and I'm like, you've got the blade, you're wearing the blade. Without the blade,
never mentioned. Maybe they frisked him and took it at the door. He was like, well, shit, I was going to use that. Never mind.
Yeah. And ultimately, the point is the up-jumped Onion Knight has a lot more in common with this little girl pressed into service. Although,
and
John obviously could have made that same speech, because he didn't want any of this stuff either.
He could have made that same speech, but he didn't know enough to read the room.
And yeah.
That's the thing that Davos is good at, I think, is picking up on how people want to be talked to.
He knows people. He's a smuggler. He's a haggler. He's lived by his wits.
Absolutely.
Even John has never, I would say, lived by his wits.
No.
He's gotten
lived
by
and
on
died
pluck
by
and
his
honor.
Honor.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did you think about this young girl playing Lady Mormont here?
I thought she was fine, and we've got feedback where people are kind of like loved her or hated her. I just think, and some people accused me, and not accused me, but suggested that it was because she was a little girl. And I don't agree because I remember, like, the kid. Do you remember Tropic Thunder? Like, the whole Vietnamese heroin ring is led by this little kid. And I thought that was dumb, too.
Sure.
Like, he's fine, giving a fine performance, but I just don't buy this foul-mouthed nine-year-old is having all these rough-and-tumble drug dealers serving him. I just feel like sometimes, like, it kind of worked for Bran when he was playing the Lord of Winterfell because his maester was speaking more for him, and I think they suggested that a little bit by having the girl confer with her maester, but she was doing most of the talking, and again, you know, she's from a long line of warriors and warrior women, and like in the book, there's a wonderful detail of like what's carved on the house of the door of their keep is a woman who's got like a battle axe in one hand, and she's standing on a dead bear with her foot, and she's nursing a child. Like that's kind of like they're proud of their warrior women culture.
Uh-huh.
And there's more of that good stuff in the books. And that works. Like, you believe, like, when you get this letter from a 9-year-old Lyanna Mormont saying that we recognize no king but Rob, King of the North, like, that works. And it just didn't in the show. And if I'm a chauvinist in any way, it's because I just don't think a 9- or 10-year-old can have that much of a physical presence. But I don't think that's the actor's fault. I think that's
I think the actor played it as well as she could have. Here's the thing. I don't give a fuck if it's a boy or a girl. It's a child.
You had the same problem in Magnolia we just watched this week with the guy, with the kid giving guff to the game show host. You don't like
the
wise...
And a lot of people are explaining that as more artistic license, and that may be fine. In this, it's not. In this, she's clearly shown to be a very... Like, it's not even wise beyond her years here. She is an adult.
So why does it work for Arya? Like, I Arya's never...
making a lot of mistakes and being petty and being vengeful. Like, she's acting more like a child.
And she's, like, it's kind of, like, by luck. But I'm thinking, like, if Arya was in a position where all of the male members in her house were killed and she's sitting as the lordess or whatever of of House Stark, how would she carry on?
I think she would be more childlike. I mean, she's on a journey to learn here, whereas I feel like this 10-year-old has... We didn't see some kind of journey that she must have gone on, and now it has produced an adult in a 10-year-old. And I just don't buy that. I mean, 10-year-olds are selfish impatient and just not spontaneous. What's the word?
Flibberty gibbets, farts in the wind.
They're just not so measured and articulate. Like, that is not a child on the screen.
If they were raised like Conan the Barbarian style to be that from the time they were weaned, do you think maybe?
I just think there are inherent things about children that would come through in their demeanor no matter how they were raised.
All right.
And I didn't see any of that here. I wish I had seen a tinge of it.
Sure.
Just like, I see this as clearly a child struggling with this, like Davos was saying.
Yeah, yeah.
She doesn't seem to be struggling with it at all. She's got it mastered and handled, and shit's on lock. And I just don't think a 10-year-old ever gets there.
All right. The other thing is Maisie Williams is incredible. And
she is.
But you can't, there's not.
So is this actress. Like, I don't know her name, but she's really good in this scene. It just doesn't work for me because of the character.
Okay. Well, I know a lot of reasonable people disagree, but that's it worked a little bit more for me because I know all the history of the Mormons and when we played the Game of Thrones the board game or Battles of Westeros the board game, Maggie Mormont, one of my mainstays. I used to fuck you up so bad as the Lannister, Maggie. I couldn't tell you the family tree, but I thought it was all awesome that that particular commander was so badass. But I'm willing to allow some artistic because I do feel like that's what the books try to portray the Mormons as.
Mm-hmm.
And they did the best they could. But I also sympathize with what you're saying, too.
Okay. The one thing that – well, the other thing that I like about the scene aside from that girl's performance is Davos. I mean,
sure.
Davos here makes an outstanding argument. You know, he comes at it at a very personal level. And I feel like this works really well on an adult who can understand why they're feeling the things they're feeling.
Yeah.
This argument, like, look, you didn't want to be in this position, but you are. I feel the same way. And we all are now.
And you're mistaken. This isn't your war, my war, our... This is our war, the living versus the dead.
Yeah.
Which I wonder... It's interesting how we got to see so many different approaches that John took with the different people, because I wonder why he, you know, why didn't they just lead with that? Uh-huh. Like, the Northerners, I think, are inclined to believe the tales, you know, especially from a Night's Watch commander coming down and saying, this is what we're facing. Like, do you think that I wanted to fight with Wildling when I signed up for the war? No, and I've killed these people, but we've seen some shit.
Change my mind.
And also, here's my look at all the cuts and scars I've got. Like, I was dead 5 days ago. What do you want?
Yeah.
I liked it. So the only thing, I guess, the big problem I had is the Mormon's keep was always cooler than I expected. Because, you know, Jorah always get that speech about how he couldn't keep his wife happy because they were so poor and they didn't have much, and then you roll up and they got this big fucking castle, which in the books are described as kind of like a dirt mound with like wooden palisades around it, and it's like very, very primitive. And here it's like, man, this is a pretty nice castle. I wouldn't be ashamed of this castle, but you hear a castle, you want to see a fucking castle. You don't want to see a thatch hut or whatever.
And, you know, he's been to King's Landing, maybe. Sure. Maybe his perspective on it has changed.
Indeed.
So Jaime meets with the Blackfish just outside of the Riverrun gates over this drawbridge that you were so amazed by in the instant take.
It's awesome.
It is pretty awesome. I'll give you that. Jaime tries to convince him to surrender, but the Blackfish is having none of it. None of it. He just treated with Jaime to get a look at him. Because sieges are boring.
I like that.
That's a great line.
They're dull affairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was so good. And I think that line's right from the book, too.
Okay.
And I also like how he's like, I assume you're here to fulfill the vow that you made to my sister, which is how you escaped my clutches in the first place. Uh-huh. Oh, you don't have my nieces? Well, I assume you're here to resume your captivity. And he's like, bargaining with the Oathbreakers is like building on quicksand. He's exactly right. Why would you believe anything that Jaime says?
Which takes me back to my Bronn argument. What the fuck, Bronn?
Sure.
But yeah, you're right. And he does blow Jaime a lot of shit here. I thought Jaime took it remarkably well. Like,
He's got
like
a dozen crossbows trained on him. And
no, I don't mean like, oh, he didn't whip out a sword and kill him right there. What I mean is, I don't think he got into Jaime's head as much as I did right after the show for the instant take.
Well,
I think Jaime stood up to it mentally.
Sure, and he said, you know, only a fool makes threats he's not prepared. Jaime's not sure what threats he's prepared to make here.
And I mean, he is making threats. We'll kill every single one of you. Thousands will die, hundreds will die, whatever. I think Jaime, like, you know, he's not dissuaded by this. He is just like, well, I didn't want it to come to this, but now it has to.
And getting the measure of people here, I thought it was interesting when the gates come down and the Blackfish is standing flanked by all these guys. Like, there might have been 50 dudes in that scene. And I was looking at the background a lot in this episode, and every one of those dudes' faces hard as granite.
Uh-huh.
There are some grim, fell faces. They're like, fuck you and your golden red armor, and we will die to a man before we give this castle up to you. It's not just a Blackfish. I was born here, and I'm going to die here. Like, every one of his men are just as committed. And I thought that was pretty nice. Uh-huh. And I think that's also something that Jaime probably took in. Like, this isn't like one guy and a whole bunch of nervous people shitting their pants, and like, this, everyone is committed to not letting me get my way.
Yeah, for sure. So he's got a tough road ahead of him, but I think he's resolved to walk it.
The key thing about Riverrun that people might is that it's literally built over a river, much like the ancient city of Babylon purported to be.
Right.
So it's extremely hard to.
Easy. You take the river in. That's how you do
sure.
it.
Sure. It's extremely hard to lay siege to this because you can't. Yeah. You can't. They've got plenty of water. They can fish from the river. They're already provisioned for 2 years. It's like, it's a very tough nut to crack.
Yeah.
In fact, it might be harder for you to stay supplied sieging them than it is for them, especially the winter coming, to just wait out the siege.
Right. And Jaime doesn't want to sit there for 2 years either. I mean,
he doesn't have the time.
Even if he could wait them out, it's a matter of time, and it's also a matter of getting back to King's Landing. I don't think he likes being out here.
And also, I think that there's also this, like, this isn't what my father would do. Like, I've got to find a way to end this and end this fast, because that's what Tywin would do, and that's how he built his reputation. And if I want to keep the Lannisters fierce, I've got to end this decisively.
Yeah.
How he does that?
Yeah, and he doesn't want to get you know, he doesn't want a battle of Thermopylae or a...
Sure.
You know, anything like that.
I think it's interesting that, unlike in the books, Jaime has Bronn by his side, and Bronn's famous for his proclamation of when they talked about the Eyrie being impregnable, said, give me 50 good men with ropes and I'll impregnate that bitch. If you need a tough nut to be cracked, maybe... I mean, that's in Bronn's wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. Maybe he'll come up with something spectacular.
He could. Maybe he'll dig a trench right in there. Just tunnel his way in.
Sure.
So we go over to John, who is trying to get the Glover's support this time. It's another failure, another huge failure from all sides. This time a complete failure, because Davos can't even save it. He fails to convince them after admitting that his forces consist mostly of wildlings. You know, the Glover guy laughs in his face. Sansa tries to play the Stark card again, which... also fails miserably.
And forget, like, I don't feel like this guy was disloyal. He's like, no. We wept for your father, we rushed to King Rob's side, and this is the other point of view where you can be a loyalist Northern and think that Rob's an idiot because he took up with a foreign whore and got himself killed and all the people following. And my castle got sacked when we were fighting this, like, you know, just war that went off the rails. Like, he's got good reasons for saying, no, fuck you. And yeah. Also, the Boltons helped me regain my castle and my family. What the fuck have you done lately?
Right. It really shows, like, they're starting to have us question whether or not the Stark name does, in fact, hold any weight in the North again.
It does, but it's going to need more, especially since the Northerners are biased about, you know, the wildlings. They've been fighting them, and the wildlings have been raping and reaving their way through their northernmost holds for... generations. There's a lot of bad blood.
Yeah, I mean, as
this
much
wasn't
as...
just a Night's Watch prejudice. This was the entire North.
Right.
And even the South, like the fucking Tarleys have a strong opinion about wildlings. Like, they are persona non grata in this country.
Yeah, and as much as Sansa holds the Stark name and that might help them, well, Jon holds this reputation as a wildling supporter.
Sure.
Which hurts them. So, like, they kind of balance each other out. Now, maybe Davos can sweet talk some more people, but it doesn't seem like he's going to. It seems like he's ready to fight.
The thing I'm worried about is that it seems likely they're setting up a stupid Sansa plot. Because Sansa's the one that kind of lost decisively this support for them. Like, I don't know that the Glovers want to support him, but maybe...
No.
Her going and compelling their support and trying to be imperious was the worst thing you could do. And her sending off this raven seems... I don't know what it contains, but, like, I'm running down the game theory of what it could be, and it doesn't look... compelling. Mm-hmm. I'm just really worried that we're going to get served the silly Sansa plot, which is fine. Like, it's completely within her character to do something rash and impetuous, and she's not good at this. But man, I'm ready for Sansa to turn the corner into being kind of a badass.
I feel like she's got such a long journey to go on. As much as Jon Snow in season one would have had a long journey to go on.
It's late. It's late to be making points that she is still a naive teenager who thinks she can later her way out of stuff. You know?
Right, but I don't want everybody at the end of the show to just be a master of their domain.
Just level up and now we're good to go,
Right. I want it to be more organic than that, and I feel like that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm certainly of two minds about it.
Yeah.
I'm weary of this stupid Sansa, but on the other hand, yeah.
Right. I'm curious... I'm still wondering how the Blackfish thing is going to play out. Now,
it doesn't appear
like Brienne got over there yet.
No, and there's no way, like, now if Sansa said, like, the one interesting possibility, she sends a raven to the Blackfish saying, come and help me.
Mm-hmm.
But he now has 8,000 men encircling him. He's not going anywhere.
No. I mean, unless Brienne can, like, talk to Jaime and change his fucking mind, but I can't imagine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, is he going to choose Cersei and his son and the kingdom over Brienne? Probably yes.
Sure.
Probably yes.
Yep.
So, I don't know.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. Yara and company are docked at some port. I'm not sure exactly where they are.
I believe this is Volantis.
This is
where
okay.
the bridge, the covered bridge, four-story covered bridge seems to be a Volantine thing.
All right, so we're picking up pretty late in their journey.
This is in Slaver's Bay. It's like on the outskirts of it, but it's in the neighborhood.
Right. So they're docked there, and they're drinking, and they're whoring, and having a grand old time. Everyone except for Theon, of course. Theon is paranoid and uncomfortable, and Yara makes him drink a whole bunch of ale, and then kind of, you know, gives him a harsh dose of reality. Look, if this is you forever, just end it. Just kill yourself.
Yeah.
If it's not you forever, I need you back. Yeah. I need you to find Theon, and we need to go do what we've got to do.
It must be said to tell a person suffering from PTSD and abuse to get drunk and kill yourself is bad advice. Mm-hmm. But ironically, Yara, a lot of people don't know this as a book detail. She's a fully licensed therapist in the Iron Islands. That's just how they roll.
Okay,
like you either get undepressed or you kill yourself again. Terrible. Like 9 times out of 10, you're going to wake up. Theon's going to be in the bathtub with his wrist slit. I do feel like it's taught entirely within these peoples and these particular characters to behave like. And I think Yara loves her brother, but she doesn't love this version of her brother. And she entirely means it. Like, I am at peace if I wake up in the morning and you're dead.
Right. And especially going back to, like, well, we tried to save you and people died. And, like, this is worthless to me.
Yeah.
This is less than worthless. It's actually harming us actively.
Yeah.
Does getting your therapy license in the Iron Islands, do you have to drown to do that? Do you have to be, like, resurrected? Dead may practice therapy.
That's pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know what? I've been there. I've died. It's not so bad, Theon.
All right, so we also saw Yara's version of carousing.
Right. Yeah, she likes the ladies.
She likes the ladies. Are we ready for a Yara wooing the Dragon Queen plot?
That's what I'm wondering. I mean, it seems like they're setting that up.
Uh-huh.
Or at least an attempt, you know? I don't know how Dany will respond to it.
Yeah, because Dany seems like she likes the dudes.
She does, yeah. I don't think we've seen any hints of Dany liking women, but I don't know. Maybe
you know,
Yara
is
convincing.
Dragons, they're as changeable as flame.
That's true. She is a dragon. In spirit, certainly.
But
yeah, they're definitely setting that up.
That was an interesting piece of an unexpected bit of Martin's razoring going on.
Yeah. I really love that line from Theon when she's like, look, I know you had some bad years. And he's like, bad years? Are you fucking kidding me? Great line. So Jon and Sansa.
That's literally the first lecture when you go to get your therapist license. It's just like, I know you've had some bad years.
So Jon, Sansa, and Davos are touring their new encampment where all the wildlings are set up. They're kind of in a valley at the foothills of a mountain there. They talk about when they're going to attack, Davos thinks that they have a shot at taking Winterfell. So does Jon. But Sansa thinks they need more men. And it seems like the men that they do have are at each other's throats.
Yep.
And then at the very end of the scene, Sansa, frustrated with Jon, spots a raven and decides to send a letter to someone.
To who and for what purpose?
I think to get more men, to get more fighting men, but I don't know to who.
Now, as I was pondering this scene, a lot was made about what good fighting ground this is at. Like, okay. Like that Stannis is one of the finest military commanders, and you've got these natural fortifications, mm-hmm. and this is like, you've got a really strong defensive advantage here. Is it possible that Sansa's sending a version of the pink letter to Ramsay to goad him into attacking at a place where not only is he giving up the defensive advantage of Winterfell, and we know that he's a fucking idiot.
That's a really good theory.
That's the best one.
How pissed would he be to get a letter from Sansa?
Yeah,
right now?
Like, oh, but yeah, you fucking broke
dick.
Here I
am.
I killed your girlfriend. I stole your plaything.
Yep.
I'm with my bastard brother who's more of a lord than you'll ever be with your fucking title. Come and get us.
I'm putting the seal on it. That's what's happening here. It makes total sense.
That would be pretty righteous.
Yeah.
Especially if Ramsay, as was popularly theorized, if Ramsay didn't write that letter, if that was a Littlefinger match. So, like, Ramsay's just minding his business, like, what the fuck? What the fuck? Yeah, he's already an idiot, and Sansa sends him this. That's the best possibility, I think.
It is.
That's pretty bold of Sansa to be mm-hmm. kind of like, not discuss this with any of my council or in my brother, and just...
And she'd better tell them after the fact. Look, I did this. It's too late to stop it.
Yeah.
But this is what's happening.
Sure.
So be prepared.
Sure. I mean, that's
essentially... Because if she doesn't say anything and they just show up...
And I'm fine with that, because, like, if fucking Sean Connery can do that in The Hunt for Red October and be seen as a badass, then so can Sansa.
Yeah.
It's good for the goose. It's good for the gander. So if that's what she's doing... That's a non-stupid Sansa thing. It's super risky, but, you know.
And I love how it uses her character's history to execute a plan. Like, and it's, I think, a smart plan. It completely removes that defensive advantage.
Especially because you got to think, like, the Glovers certainly said no to Jon.
Yes.
But do the Glovers go to war against the Starks?
That's a good question. They won't help
and
them,
that's the thing, like, maybe also
them.
Sansa's and, like, yeah, they're not going to help us on an offensive war, but if we're being, like, are they going to fight against us? Like, how, like, this cuts both ways. They're of two minds, but if Ramsay calls his banners to march against the last surviving Starks, how many really answer the call?
Or, if they answer the call, do they pull, like, a Braveheart sort
sure.
of thing
and
defect to the other side,
yeah.
right? Like,
yeah.
That could totally happen. Like, you get the Umbers up there,
sure.
and maybe... You know, it was kind of all part of the plan. Who knows?
Yep. It's going to be exciting. There's three more episodes. Man, there's going to be so much shit that happens.
Yeah. Next one looks really good, by the way.
All right.
Anyway, so Deadwood guy tells his followers all about the bad things he's done, how remorseful he is, and now he's just trying to do good because it's never too late to come back, and he's kind of eyeing Sandor while he's talking about that. That seems to land with the Hound, but unfortunately a trio of assholes ride up and menace them. After they leave, the Hound says that they should fight to protect themselves and continues angrily chopping wood right through dinner.
All right. Do we think this is the Brotherhood Without Banners?
That's what he said, right?
Do we think that if we agree that those are the... So it makes sense because they said it was the Brotherhood and they all worship the Seven now since... the Lord of Light since Barrett came back from the dead.
And they use that phrase...
the night's dark and full of terrors.
Right, yep.
On the other hand, we don't know who came back and killed all the people.
Fair.
And is also possible that bands of outlaws are operating as the Brotherhood Without Banners. Like, I mean, unless I see, like, Thoros or Beric or Gendry,
right.
Gendry's not there anymore. Anyone that we are recognizably a part of the bunch, like the archer that was so badass, I'm going to be skeptical that this is really the Brotherhood because this is and I got lots of feedback on it. This is very wildly out of character for them. They are the protector of the small folk. Mm-hmm. And here we got them preying on them for no good damn reason.
Right.
So I'm wondering what is afoot here. There is something afoot. I'm not sure what it is.
Okay. I don't have too much else to say about that scene. I have a lot to say about the next one, though. Arya.
The other thing is, you want to talk about the limits of pacifism in a world like this? Like, the Septon says, violence is a disease. You don't cure it by spreading it. And the Hound comes back, nor by dying.
Right. They're pretty obvious. They're laid bare in this episode.
Yeah.
I mean, every single one of them is killed.
Also, do you think that the Hound is going to feel especially guilty because if he had heeded this call to fellowship, you've done enough, come and get some stew, maybe the Hound could have been there and turned the tide.
Or maybe he would have been killed along with
him. Or maybe have been killed along with him. There's a point they're making here, and I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah. I mean, I think pacifism doesn't work in a world like that.
I don't think it works.
A civilization.
I think absolute pacifism is never going to work, period. But
sure. I haven't thought about it that much to state that emphatically, but I understand why you think that. Yeah.
I mean, if you're not willing to fight for pacifism, then you're going to lose to anyone that is.
Yeah. And if you're a true pacifist, you can't fight. So
sure. What are you going to do?
Right. Let's move over to Arya, who I don't think is a pacifist. She's bribing.
She'll pass the fist right to your jaw.
Yep, like Jaime will. Arya bribes a ship captain to take her to Westeros. She strolls through the city looking at the sights and gets attacked on a bridge by Waif, disguised as an old woman. She's stabbed. She falls into the water. And once Waif is gone, she's, just a little more paranoid as she stumbles through the streets bleeding.
So lots of people wrote in with problems with this scene.
Oh, yeah.
But on subsequent watches, I'm convinced there's some Ocean's 11 type bullshit going on.
Oh, yeah.
That we're going to get a scene that later reveals that this was not a real SWAT team, that the duffel bags were stuffed full of porno ads, that there's no fucking way that Arya throws this gold around and buys conspicuous patches to Westeros and then is just fucking around. We just saw her in hiding in the darkness, and now she's just strolling around without a care in the world and gets killed by the Waif. Like, there's
so nonchalant.
Got to be, like, I think we're going to find out that Arya did not, in fact, get stabbed. And
yeah.
There was an interesting image that someone posted on Reddit that shows in the scene where Arya's walking through the crowds before she gets stabbed, there is a person from the back that is wearing the exact Arya in her oysters, clams, and cockles Mercy outfit.
Okay.
I think they're already setting us up that there might even be multiple Aryas. Now, I don't know how all this works. I'm assuming that it will make sense once we get the reveal, but I don't believe that Arya got stabbed.
I don't either. She's acting too nonchalant. I think the most damning thing is she doesn't have Needle on her.
Yes.
I can't see Arya abandoning Needle.
Especially in Braavos, where going around with a sword on your hip is like a very common thing.
Yeah.
They do street dueling and all kinds of shit in Braavos.
Right. I mean, is she just touring the city without a weapon, buying passage?
Again,
obviously,
just
like
splashing cash around like you're a dumb gangster in a Goodfellas production.
It's incredibly stupid. Where did she get the money?
Yeah.
I mean, did she go around stealing a bunch of money before
this?
She
could, sure. But that's against.
She could, but that's even more obvious.
Yeah,
it's
like she's showing up in her pink Cadillac and she's getting out in her fur coat and she's saying, hey, I want the best passage possible. That's not the Arya we know.
Okay, let me ask you
And
this.
I think it's funny that the scene works so well as this is Arya getting stabbed, even though it is not consistent at all with what we know about the way Arya carries herself and what she's learned from dealing with the Faceless Men.
And carries herself is important. I mean, even the way she's walking doesn't feel like Arya. Now, we know Arya is trained to blend in and trained to act and all these sorts of things, but it doesn't feel like Arya in those scenes. The other thing, let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Okay, do it.
If it's not her, why this whole out of the water act?
Walking
down the street, bleeding, and being so paranoid, and being surprised and shocked.
That's a good question because
if this is part of a plan,
maintaining the POV throughout that is the greatest argument in the favor of that is Arya, who just miscalculated and was stupid and got stabbed.
Right.
And again, it's not like the Waif has no skill as well.
What do you mean?
Well, it's actually very hard to show two people who are very smart and skilled at getting the better at each other to have one believably get the. That's why it takes something like an Ocean's 11 or an Italian Job. Like it's the work of a whole 2.5-hour movie to work yourself up to the point where that pays off satisfyingly, right?
Or like a 13-episode season in the case of like season 4 Breaking Bad.
Okay, sure.
Like that's what I think.
Sure, it takes a while to show like two very smart people that are good at doing these things. One of them is just a little bit better. So
yeah.
In that case, I feel like they did a poor job at showing the Waif just ultimately winning. And they also show, I mean, you know, all this stuff that they've used to this point, like the Waif just handing Arya her ass single-handedly without being armed, like all this is to serve this one scene. So you have a debate like this, like, was it Arya? Did she really forget all she's, was the Waif that much better? Like, I feel like the Double D's intended us to have this debate and to feel this way.
So I'm going to go with a theory here.
Do it.
That I've partially seen.
Serving up some dry pie.
Well, probably, yeah, most likely. I haven't read any of the emails, so sorry if I do. But
you can't. That's like anytime you're talking, anytime you're emailing, you're talking to me because as a historical quirk, I set up the Game of Thrones mailbox so it only goes to me and not you.
So I wouldn't get spoilers early on.
Yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
Now
I should probably
matter.
Undo that, but it's kind of fun.
Anyway, so I think this is also a big test for the Waif.
Sure,
because. There's a scene last episode where Waif goes to Jaqen and she says, I'm going to go after her. You promised me. Mm-hmm. He says, don't let her suffer. Yeah. Don't make her suffer. Now, Waif, when she grabs Arya in this episode, could have slit her throat.
Yep.
Instead, she chose to stab her in the guts.
Mm-hmm.
That's suffering.
And twist the knife, which is an idiom.
Slice her, stab her twice.
Which is an idiom for inflicting the maximum emotional and physical pain. When you twist the knife, you're going above and beyond what you need to do to kill someone.
So I think what's happening here is some faceless person, whether it's Jaqen or whether it's someone that Jaqen sent to test the Waif. I keep calling her the Waif. It's just Waif, right? That's her name.
I don't think she hasn't. No, it's the Waif.
It's the Waif.
We refer to her as the Waif in the books.
Okay. All
right. She doesn't have a name because she's no one.
But I don't know if it's Jaqen. Like a lot of people are saying, oh, this is Jaqen disguised as Arya. I don't think so. I don't think. Whoever you think Jaqen is, whether Jaqen is actually Jaqen, we don't know. But the character that we know as Jaqen, I don't think he's disguised as Arya. I think it's some other faceless person.
Could be.
Yet
another initiative going through their test. Who knows?
Right. And this is set up to test the Waif.
I think, and you got to say that she is, like, she's botched a mission as bad as Arya ever has. Because not
in
only.
Spirit and letter.
Yeah, she didn't fulfill the death contract. And. If she did, she didn't do it the way she was instructed to do it, and she's also got emotion and passion behind it, which is not what the faceless men are all about.
Right.
So I do feel like that's part of the Ocean's 11 reveal that the Waif is done fucked up as well.
Yeah.
She's fallen in the same trap that Arya has.
I think so. Okay. Anything else to say about this scene?
I do want to say that there's also some compelling similarities between Arya and the Hound. That, like, if this is Arya, it works on a level because the Hound was killed by a woman and left for dead, ironically trying to protect Arya. And Arya and the Hound are wearing very similar outfits. So the Hound staggers back to see all of the people he cares about now dead and swears revenge. Arya is staggering and bleeding and has been betrayed by this person, which reflects the Hound's story in season 4. And the Hound coming back to see all the people he cared about being killed reflects Arya's arc in season 1 and 2. I thought that was pretty interesting, showing that maybe these characters are going to be bound more tightly together in the future as they were in the past.
Yeah, I do like that with the time they spent together.
And even if it's just an artistic thing, I like the symmetry, especially when you cut the one scene right from the other.
Right. Okay, let's go to the last scene. It's the Hound still chopping wood when he hears some screams. When he gets back to his group, they're all dead. Deadwood guy has been hanged. And the Hound picks up an axe and walks off. Looks pretty angry.
Yeah, when he picks up the axe, feels like he's going to split the earth with it.
It's on. I can't wait.
Yeah, I would hate to be the Brotherhood right now.
Mm-hmm.
If that indeed is the Brotherhood. Yeah, it's incredibly strong.
And I think it's an indictment of, you know, the Deadwood guy's attitude. I don't think you can live in this world and be a pacifist.
Sure, sure.
At least not in its current state.
Great. I mean, I want to say it's the greatest non-big, splashy Game of Thrones scene episode ever. You know...
Okay.
Like it's not a Blackwater. It's not a Hard Home, but just pound for pound, a badass dialogue and really nice character moments and satisfying payouts and reveals. I thought it's pretty. It's right up there.
I feel like they're really setting up an epic episode 8.
Sure.
At least I'm hoping for it.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
I don't know. Like 9's usually the hammer, but man,
they've done 8 too. Wasn't Hard Home 8?
You might
last
be
season?
Right.
I think
it's either
so.
6 or 8, but yeah.
Oh, geez, was that early?
Well, that's the thing. Like, there's some in later seasons they've kind of broken with that because, like, season 4, you had incredible moments throughout. You had the Purple Wedding, and you had, I believe,
right.
the Mountain and the Viper was episode 8 as well. So
yeah, Hard Home is episode 8.
Okay, there you go. So yeah, we could get who knows? Who knows?
We'll see.
Hey, I'm here to tell you about the club at club.baldmove.com. We got a hot feature hitting tomorrow, Wednesday, this week, which is the episode, our playthrough of Telltale's Game of Thrones House Forester saga. It's the final episode of the first season. I thought it might be the final episode ever, but it turns out it seems like there's going to be a second season because this very felt like the end of a season of Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were committed to the destruction of House Forrester. We wanted to ineptly manage it into the ground, and I think we did a pretty damn good job, Jim. Hard to imagine House Forrester being in a worse position if you tried, and we did. So if that sounds entertaining, you want to see us playing through and cracking jokes and just trying to run a house into the ground, go to baldmove.com tomorrow, be a club member, and you can see our playthrough of that. And if you're not sure if it's worth it, I'm going to include a link to the first playthrough we did at the first episode for free, so you can get several hours of an idea of what these things are like. So there's that. We also have ad-free feeds and VIP forum features, shows like Silent Movies and Quit Your Pitchin', which are purely bonus content, and Lunch with Jim and Aaron, and On the Rocks with Jim and Aaron. A lot of features that are more geared to if you like the Bald Move community. And more importantly, it's just a way to help support us, because I'm telling you right now, we couldn't do 3 podcasts a week on Game of Thrones if we were not doing this as a full-time job, because it takes up a lot of time and effort. And as evidence for that, we never did 3 podcasts when we were doing this part-time. So if you'd like to support independent podcast and keep the hits coming and help us out, we'd appreciate your support at club.baldmove.com. It's as little as a buck a month. So we're not asking for much, just enough to help keep our lights on, and appreciate all the support in advance. Shall we get to feedback now?
Yeah, let's do it.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. Again, we were a day early, so this might feel a little light. Also, forums at baldmove.com if you want to discuss it. And, you know, don't forget, we got Friday coming up for the spoiler edition if you're not spoiler averse, if you're not afraid of book info. Sure, we'll have a lively conversation. Rob from Illinois said, I was just wondering how the understudy actress could afford the price the faceless men charge to kill a person. I was under the impression that the faceless men charge astronomical sums of money to perform a hit. Remember in season 1 where they're talking about assassinating Danny? Littlefinger said they could buy an army of cell swords for the price it would take for a faceless men to kill a merchant, let alone a princess.
Then again, Arya got 3 names, got 3 people killed.
For saving 3 people, sure.
Right. So, I mean, there are other ways to pay, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, and in the books they go into a little bit more detail that the price is always dear. Like,
okay.
If you're a rich man, it might cost a shit ton of gold. But if you're a poor person, maybe you have to sacrifice your daughter. Or, you know, like, it's always something that it's just shy of what you're unwilling to give. And it's a great personal cost to you.
Yeah.
So what is that, you know? The other thing is, you know, we'll have some theories about maybe it wasn't. Maybe Ari was wrong and it wasn't the understudy that took out this hit. Like, but if it was, I don't know what a poor up-and-coming actress could pay, but, you know, it's something. It's something. Caleb C. says, I was listening to the Tuesday podcast and was interested in the discussion of Cyril Ferrell. This is speculation that he could be a faceless man and he could potentially be alive and able to save Arya. However, there seemed to be doubt of this scenario because of Cyrio's motto towards the god of death is not today. Isn't it possible, perhaps even likely, though, that Cyril is a former faceless man? Then his motto would be an act of defiance against an old religion that he no longer follows. I don't know if he is alive or is about to help Arya, but him being a faceless man should definitely be in play. Or I guess a former faceless man. That's not a bad theory. Like, again,
that's like saying, oh, I was once a Jehovah's Witness, so I'm prone to being one again? Like,
No. I think he's saying that, like, because the reason I say he can't be a faceless man is because he says, what do we say to the God of death, not today, which is an anathema. It'd be more like if I'm a Jehovah's Witness and I say, you know,
there
fuck
is no God.
Jehovah.
Sure.
Or so, you know, that's kind of like, and I do. I do say things like, you know, I'm an atheist from time to time. So I guess that would make sense, yeah?
But we're talking about it in the context of him swinging back into action on a rope from a balcony. Like, that doesn't wash with him no longer being a faceless man.
Why? Because he could have all the skills and abilities of a faceless man. Because that does seem like it's some kind of practical. I mean, yeah, it might be magic, but it's magic in the same way that, you know, you've got a spell.
Right. So I guess, do you think that Arya can still do the things that she was able to do under their tutelage? And I guess the answer would be yes. So I guess Sirio, maybe if he was a former faceless man, could do that. But how? Like, how did he find her? Like,
sure.
How does he know where she even is?
Well, like, so there's also this theory that
no one knows where she is.
But there's also a theory that Sirio was Jaqen, and that, like, he was tutoring Arya. Like, she's somehow special. Like, she's the princess that was promised to them or something.
So
Jaqen was Sirio, protected, and then Sirio dies, and it turns out Jaqen then turns up to continue her tutelage, gives her the Iron Coin. She used the Iron Coin, okay. So it's like it's been Jaqen, it's Jaqen all the way down. It's turtles all the way to the bottom.
I will just say that is a lot of speculation.
Indeed.
A lot, with zero supporting evidence.
And I've made peace with the fact that Sirio's probably dead. Like, I was the biggest Sirio, we didn't see him die kind of supporter.
Right.
But on the other hand, so and that's what's dangerous about me as a critic in this case, because I really kind of want that to be true. And
sure.
I'm prepared to swallow a lot more bullshit than you, I think, are to make that true. And probably a
I
lot
think
of
so.
People.
Yeah.
So.
But I don't know. I wouldn't call myself a critic. I don't know if you'd call yourself that, but we're having conversations as fans, so
yeah.
I think you have a little license to want some things to happen.
Sure, sure. And that's the one thing I worry about, because what are you going to do?
Yeah.
I want that to happen, and I'll be prepared to... My disbelief is firmly suspended. It's on concrete pillars with, like, iron scantlings and stuff. Like, it's very secure.
Right.
An average fan might crumble a little bit more. I don't know. Moving on to Spencer H. said, whoever wrote the Dothraki language did a phenomenal job. It's almost hard to believe a speech in a made-up language could sound that badass and convincing. Also, props to Emilia Clarke for pulling it off so flawlessly. So I looked into it, and I was actually surprised that Dothraki is a joint project between David J. Peterson and George R. R. Martin. And David graduated from Berkeley with a degree in English and linguistics, and he's actually done several invented languages. He did the, like, dark elvish language in Thor 2. What's germane to my interest is he also invented the Verbis Diablo, the devil speech from Penny Dreadful, which I'm covering with my co-host Cecily on Penny Earful, which is a podcast we're doing right now. If you're a fan, you want to check that out on baldmove.com. So he's done a lot of this. He's kind of, and I guess that's his claim to fame, that he actually breaks it down and thinks, like, what the basic grammar and syntax so it sounds like a believable language. And that's his oogie boogie.
I feel like him and Davos need to get together and commiserate over how they're in places they never thought they'd be. Like, going as a English and linguistics major, you can't foresee a future where you're creating new languages for fiction.
You know, I bet that's not that hard, because there's precedent for it. Like, J.R.R. Tolkien, I mean, that was his. Like, he's this big English scholar, and he's one of the, you know, modern translators of Beowulf, and he also invented a shit ton of languages. So I bet there is...
But it's not like you're a web developer, and you can see the immediate need for these things, and
there's
a lot of that. That
sure.
demand.
Yeah, no.
It's like, there's one dude in Hollywood who does this, and if you're lucky enough to be him, that's rad, but...
Yeah.
Whew.
Yeah. Inazi had a lot of clarifications and affirmations of the points we made in the previous podcast. We talked about whether Bran, seeing the future as well as the past and present, is that something a Greenseer is in a wellhouse, and she linked to a... scene where Jojen told Bran when they first met that he can indeed see the past, present, and future as a Green Seer. So him seeing the future is a confirmed thing, or at least an opinion of Jojen.
Gotcha.
Secondly, I wondered whether we had the scene of Cersei, or I'm sorry, of Jaime sitting upon the Iron Throne, if we'd ever heard of that or seen it before. And I shouldn't have known that the Double D's would have invented a book on, or a show only scene to give us a detail that's found only in the books. But when Cersei's talking to Ned and they're talking about you gotta, when you play the Game of Thrones, either win or die, she mentions that when, you know, Jaime told me the story of when you came home and you found him on the throne and you kicked him off, okay, and you should have sat it, that was your mistake. So that's confirmed. And also, she found two other scenes where when Bran warged into Hodor, you got the brief image of his eyes flashing the white, and then they resume to the natural hue, and he goes apeshit. So
is that
you can't
not this not in the door, but in other episodes?
Yeah, he's
like
been
the previous time that he warged
into
Hodor.
Yeah, there's one where he did. Yeah, there's one he did when the wildlings were attacking a tower and they're hiding out, and he warged into Hodor to shut him up. And then there is also the door. There's also the door episode, and there's also the one where they were confronting the Black Brothers at Craster's Keep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay.
So, if you want to cite Hodor's lack of eye whiteness to say that Bran's not warged into him, I'm no more on the subject. I think it's like, if you want to believe that Hodor was noble side, whatever, it doesn't matter to the plot.
No.
If it comes up again, I'm happy to consider it, but I'm considering the matter closed now.
Good.
All right, moving forward to Faith from North Carolina says, in season 3, Arya met Melisandre in the Riverlands where she was with the Brotherhood Without Banners. She comes for Gendry. When Arya protests, Melisandre looks into her eyes and says, I see darkness in you. I see eyes staring back at me. Blue eyes, brown eyes, etc., etc. We will meet again. Does this mean Arya will make it back over to Westeros? This was actually from last week, but I thought it was prescient because if you take Melisandre's words to be prophetic, isn't this kind of evidence that Arya cannot die? At least not yet.
Well, you know, she thought that about Stannis, too. So, I don't know how much I really take Melisandre's
because
words.
There's also theories that I've considered ridiculous up until this point, that Arya, that the Faceless Men might use Arya's face to do something.
Mm-hmm.
And not literally Arya, and that would be literally true if Melisandre meets a faceless man or woman, faceless no one, wearing Arya's face. That could make this literally true.
And we might have actually just seen that this episode.
If you
don't believe that was
Melisandre,
actually Arya.
But she didn't meet Melisandre. We have to see her meet Melisandre to make the prophecy come true.
No. I mean what you said about the faceless men using Arya's face to do something.
Certainly.
Test the waif, maybe.
Certainly. So there's that, but that's the thing. Like I don't think my interpretation is Melisandre did not see false things. Melisandre interpreted them wrongly. So if she says, I saw your eyes with many other eyes and so much blood and we'll meet again, I think that's literally true, but it could be again, fulfilled by a faceless person wearing an Arya mask. Moving on, Jordan M. from Connecticut says, I couldn't imagine Dany as a villain. This is something we talked about, like maybe Dany is the big villain instead of the savior of the show. And she's shown signs of instability and the madness runs in her family.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I didn't see her as a villain because she's worked so hard to break up slavery and has so far eluded the Targaryen crazy curse, and the dragons would seem to be an integral part of the defeat of the White Walkers. But after watching episode 606, I've seen her differently. As a character, I still like her and her motivations make sense, but who is she kidding? The way it's looking, Dany will travel to Westeros on dragons, with an army of Dothraki, Unsullied, and Second Son Sellswords, advised by Tyrion, Jorah, and Varys. On Euron Greyjoy's ships? That motley crew is not going to make Westeros great again. Aside from the Unsullied, the rest of her army is a slash-and-burn, purely destructive force that no one in Westeros can rally behind. Is she planning on using fear and devastation to sow disrespect and rule of law? What kind of story will this end up being if Dany swoops in on Drogon and burns the fuck out of everyone? This is something I've been asking rhetorically. What is Gurm playing at with this story?
Right.
What kind of story is he telling? And we just don't know. Because you're right. Pirates and Mongol hordes and cutthroat sellswords are not the kind of army a virtuous person rides to the head of. On the other hand, Jorah was a traitor. Dario was a sellsword who betrayed his own people. She has turned them into true believers. Like, maybe through the sheer force of her cult of personality, she can make these people not be the rapist, murdering thieves that they are.
Yeah. No, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at it from the real world perspective and maybe some of the influences that Martin is using when he writes, do you think that he would write essentially what is an anathema in our world, which is to our world, which is a benevolent dictator? Is that what you think he's getting at with Danny?
Well, I mean, like I
said, because it's not very realistic.
Right.
And if you think he's writing from a realistic place, which he kind of said he wanted to make Lord of the Rings a little more realistic.
Sure. He wanted to ground it more.
More interesting.
Real, yeah.
Then maybe that's just not a place we're going to get to.
Could be. Like I said, I still think that Danny, as, you know, installing a parliamentary style democracy is kind of like a plausible end game.
Yeah.
And in which case she's leading a coalition of the willing who are true believers to her way of life. But, you know, it's also entirely possible that she is a false messiah.
Sure.
Or was a genuine messiah who gets corrupted. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also some interesting symmetry between, like, we don't have any problem seeing the Night's Watch as a force for good, and yet they made no bones about it that these were a bunch of common thieves and rapists and murderers and crazy,
right,
and insane people. Like, these were all the undesirable dregs of Westeros that you're fighting with. Now,
yeah, that's a good point.
You've had mutiny after mutiny. So, like, some of this stuff is kind of like, you can't, if you want to draw a parallel between Dany's forces and these, it doesn't look so good for her. But I don't know, maybe this is the counterpoint to that. If you expect more from people, that they're happy to give it. I don't know. What is Gurm playing at? That's a question we can ask ourselves continually.
Mm-hmm.
Moving on to Samantha J. I'm curious about the seeming lack of repercussions relating to Ramsay's disposal of Walda Frey and her son. Presumably Walda Frey knows of Roose Bolton's demise, as Ramsay made a point of sending ravens around to tell everyone. Frey would probably also be aware that Walda was pregnant with an heir to the Bolton title. Wouldn't Walda Frey be suspicious of Ramsay and be concerned for the safety of his kin? Wouldn't someone have let it slip to the Freys that he fed her and the newborn son to his dogs? It seems like this would have been a big deal to the Freys. What do you think?
I don't know how much, respect I have for Walda Frey as a tactician, as a... I mean, he pulled off the Red Wedding, but
yes,
he's an old kook. He's more angry than he is cunning, I think, at this point. I don't know.
But he's also very calculating. Like, in the first season, Catelyn said that her father used to refer to him as the late Walda Frey, because he only showed up to the battle to support the usurper, Robert Baratheon's forces, when it was very clear that he was winning.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's kind of like, I'm washing my hair, or I just got... He's got all these excuses for why he can't take the field. The river's flooded, whatever. And then when one side's winning, he can swoop in and be like, aha, I was on your side all along.
Yeah.
So he is a little bit more calculated than this. Now,
right. Okay.
Maybe he's just preoccupied with River Run. That seems foolish, because I would be suspecting that the Boltons were going to fuck me if I was him. But I don't know whether that's a plot hole or a character point, and I guess we'll have to see how it goes down from here. Ross B. said, you asked why Walda Frey didn't leave the twins to go take up the seat of Riverrun, and this is the explanation I have come up for you. Walda is old as balls. He has already gone through 19 wives, and it's possible he's too old to travel. Sure, the Tullys have looked down upon him his entire life, but he may be content to just stay in the castle he has, which is also still pretty important location tactically, and let one of his 20 sons sit in Riverrun. It just didn't work out for him. I don't know about him being too old to travel, but the twins is his whole source of power and why he is a thing in Westeros. And we already have established that he doesn't trust his sons at all. So, like, Riverrun, if he loses it, it's a embarrassment to him, but it doesn't do anything to his power. As long as he controls the crossing of the Trident, he is a political force in Westeros. Or unless someone, like, he just has an army that they can just take it from him.
Yeah.
But, so that's a good point, Ross. Spencer R. says, one of my many issues with the Night's King is that he stands as this one-dimensional representation of evil. Watching the show, I find myself wondering, what's his motivation? Is it just that the series hasn't presented us with anyone as shallow as the Night's King before, a character that appears to only want to destroy everyone and have a legion of brainless followers? It's so uncharacteristic of Gurm's characters. Then when you read your email about the Knights, what the Night's King wants with Bran, and it occurred to me if the Night's King could convert Bran, that he could possibly use Bran to effect change in the past, such as his very creation, of which he seems to be an unwilling participant. This motivation makes a bit more sense to me than just merely the bad guy is bad. What do you think? Is the Night's King a shallow, one-dimensional character that George Martin says he didn't want to create?
I think the answer is clearly no. We just don't know what the truth of it is yet.
Yeah.
Because like he says in the email, he clearly was not a willing participant.
Sure.
We know that the Children of the Forest created the Night's King, and then it obviously got away from him.
Sure.
Like, now it's actively fighting against them. How did that happen? What was the road to that? We don't know yet.
And if we want to lean into this Tolkien comparison, one of the big things that motivate Tolkien to write The Lord of the Rings was his very personal reaction to the mechanized horrors of World War I, which he fought in. Right. And I've been thinking about, you know, one of the modern scourges that we deal with today is like unexpended ordnance and landmines. Like, these things are just mined the fuck out of places in the world, and it reaps a grim harvest down, and like mines laid down 40, 50 years ago kill children and farmers today. Mm-hmm. And it's like a big issue. Like, a country spend a lot of money reclaiming these landmine fields. And it's kind of interesting that these are weapons from long forgotten, obsolete wars that are still killing today. And that feels relevant to the Night's King.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a hot theory that if he's trying to subvert Bran so he can undo his own creation, maybe it's arguable that the Night's King is like this virtuous character. Like, he might be,
or at least has an understandable motive, right?
Like, well, if he undoes that, like, what? How much suffering would he undo through the thousands and thousands of years of his history?
Right.
And also, like, I think it's also kind of just, I don't think he's one-dimensional because it is tragic. He was an unwilling victim, and now he's this dangerous automaton just going around killing things.
Sure.
So even just a plain face reading, I think, is a little bit more interesting than just this is a manifestation of evil in the world.
Right. And we just haven't seen enough yet.
Yeah.
To really know his true motivations.
One other thing. A couple people asked me, and I thought that would come up in conversation, but I think I just barely remembered it now. Some people had a problem with Davos referring to him as the Night King. Like, how the fuck does Davos know that's his name? You got any idea?
No, I have no idea.
I mean, the way I would make an analogy to this is, let's say, you know, you don't believe in Satan the devil or Lucifer, or but what if, just for sake of argument, in 2020...
I saw him.
Like literally, like on CNN, the United States Army or the UN Army is fighting a 20-foot-tall, bipedal, hoofed, red, horn, fork-tail creature with demonic fire. He might not be literally the devil, but for lack of a better word, if people call him Satan or Mephistopheles or whatever the fuck his name is, or any of the different, like, I don't think people would be like, how the hell do you know that's devil? Like, the Night King is a legend in Westeros,
right?
And when you're confronted with someone who looks and acts and has the behavior of the legendary figure, I think Davos would say, like, I don't think that's a show only creation. This is a legendary creature,
yeah,
that people have just forgotten about that's real. So that's kind of the way I see it.
Sure.
Vanessa W. says, do you think Cersei knew ahead of time that Tommen had decided to align with the Faith Militant, which was the secret that he wasn't supposed to tell her? I wouldn't put it past her to set up Lady Olenna and the rest of House Tyrell in this way. What better way to get Jaime to become Lord of Castle Rock? She certainly wouldn't want Kevin to take over the title, given his contempt for her. I think this theory would also explain why she was so calm afterwards. Now, you'd have to believe this theory, you'd have to believe that Cersei keeps this from Jaime. That this is a long con she's planning to get her lover to be the rightful heir of Castle Rock again, etc., etc., etc. How plausible do you think this is?
Well, I've already kind of stated that I think she has just straight up lost and that Marjorie is actually pulling more of the strings here now.
Okay.
So I'm sticking with that.
All right.
I don't think it's the case, but
fair enough.
Sure. I mean, if you want to go down that path, you do have to contend with the, like what you said about Jaime not knowing.
Sure.
And I don't know that it's above Cersei to plan her own stuff, without telling people who are directly involved.
Sure. She could be sansing it up.
Yeah.
Jessica H. says, what if the waif was the one who actually contracted Arya to kill the actress from the play? Oh, bomb. The episode prior, Arya told the waif that Cersei was on her list. Could she have been trying to put Arya into a position where she knew she would fail so that she could get permission to kill her? That's an interesting theory because it sidesteps the how in the world would the actress afford the Faceless Men. Like, the waif herself took out a contract.
But how would she do that? Like,
I mean, I don't know if there's a law that says, like, Faceless Men cannot participate in their own business.
It seems like that's pretty self-serving, although we know that the waif is pretty self-serving.
That's what I'm saying.
Here, right?
Like, so far, nothing is not lining up with this theory.
Right, right.
Now, there's very little evidence for this theory, but...
It's almost a theory of the gaps. Like, how did this woman afford to assassinate her?
And why was the waif so interested in probe? I mean, that was part of her job to determine if Arya was no one or not, but... Mm. I mean, it's very circumstantial, but there's nothing that says it's not true, and it's also somewhat compelling in that it shows that there's an additional wheel of the machination that we didn't suspect before.
Right.
So we'll see, but I like it. I like it, Jessica. Melody from Oklahoma City said, did it strike you guys as convenient that the Hound just happened to be the only person not in the camp when this attack happened?
Sure.
I'm not even sure where to go with that, but I thought it was odd. What's your thoughts, Jim?
No, it's a TV thing, you know?
But
we need him to be here so he gets angry and he stays out chopping wood a little
longer.
But is
it odd that... Out of all the, you know, the all the
law, it's fortunate.
But what I'm saying is, yeah, it's like all the laws of nature have conspired that intelligence has arisen on the face of Earth. Like, you could say that that's evidence for a creator, or you could say, well, it's the weak anthropic principle. If the universe was set up in any other way, we wouldn't be around to observe it.
Right.
So if the story went down, like if Sandor was there and he died, or Sandor was there and he protected, then the story wouldn't have unfolded the way we did. It did to me. It's not as coincidental because they established that Sandor, he doesn't like to be touched. He's not comfortable with people. He wants to help those people and do his part, but he's not ready to be a part of the congregation. So it makes sense that he would, you know, keep himself busy at the outskirts of camp.
And they did a little lampshading of the fact that this was going to happen with him kind of sitting away from everybody else while he's eating.
Yep.
A lot of people don't like you around here.
Yep.
Well, I'm used to it.
Yep.
That sort of thing. So, and, you know, then he... He gets angry and he goes out and chops wood.
Kelly T said half this episode is Gurm's version of a Shark Tank, or rather the Stark Tank. With only the Glovers turning, going, I'm out, I feel like Jon and Sans are doing fairly well. However, they need to turn over all future pitches to Davos. This is just an elaborate Shark Tank joke.
I think they're doing shittily.
Really?
I don't think they're doing fairly well. I think without Davos, they're up shit creek with nobody.
The only Glover said I'm out though.
Tormund saved the day with the wildlings. They were ready to be out
still
too.
You're not refuting the point that only the Glovers are out, Jim.
No, what I'm refuting is the idea that Jon and Sansa are to credit for getting any troops. No, it's been Tormund and Davos all the way.
Well, they picked their advisors well.
Yeah.
Aaron in Boston said, I gotta totally disagree with you about the Lyanna Mormont scene. I thought it was totally awesome. I wonder if your reaction to it not being super believable springs from the fact that I cannot think of any time in the history of TV that I've seen a female child be that cold, hard, and badass. I mean, this is a girl who has a shit ton of responsibilities, that hails from a culture of warrior women, and has seen her whole family die. If anyone would be that hard, she would. I thought the actress was great also. I also agree that Davos saved the scene, but I think he saved it from Jon and Sansa. Those two need to get hard if they want anyone to follow them, and they both appeared weak in this episode. And that's really what I took from that scene in the Glover scene. This little girl knows what's up. Catch up, Jon. Kill the boy. So I wanted to read that just to get the other side, you know?
Right,
and
right. I've already said it's not about her being a girl. It's about her being a child.
And also, this is a subjective thing, so there is not a universal truth. It's like she didn't either crush or crap the scene. Like, it's entirely in the eye of the beholder, and I think Aaron did a good job of laying out how you could buy that. So
right. I also would disagree with the idea that they need to suck on concrete and get hard. I think Sansa tried that.
True.
It didn't fucking work. And Davos came around with a little more nuanced and measured approach, and it worked.
Different strokes for different folks.
What they need is wisdom, which neither of those people have yet.
And even Davos is like, got the makings of a good advisor, but he's, you know, he's the Onion Knight. Before that, he was a smuggler, and before that, he was a crab fisher's son, or whatever the hell he said he was.
Yeah.
Craig says, for the how are we going to know what episode it is in so that we can be properly prepared? Obviously, I'm going to need some chicken so I can eat every fucking chicken in the room. Mm-hmm. I need to have a fire extinguisher ready. I'll probably have to have someone call or have to call someone a cunt. Will they give us an episode title like The Mountain versus the Viper, or will they only give us a preview scene? What if the unthinkable happens and the hype fails us? Oh, Jesus.
Oh,
that's
no.
You can't.
Shut your mouth.
I mean, the contra of what is hype may never die is what is dead can never hype. Yeah.
Oh,
like,
man.
Which side of the coin are we going to get, Jim? So you got to call, you got to say fuck the king. You got to get, that's another part of your preparation.
Mm-hmm.
But I just checked so far, the last two episode titles are TBD.
Oh.
So if it is the click, it would be. What would happen to the internet if episode 9 comes out and it's just Clegane Bowl?
That'd be pretty badass.
Or if it's just get hype at all capital 6 exclamation marks.
I think they're too dedicated to their fiction to do that, but I think that would be amazing.
Or if it's just in brackets Vuvuzela horn. I don't know, man, because I don't know how they're going to telegraph it, because they got to be careful because...
Yeah.
You know, obviously, this is one of the most popular theories of all time, and all the information is out there. It's funny because someone, and this is why I don't read this kind of stuff. It's too on the nose. But someone on Thursday sent me a message essentially outlining what if Sandor's not dead because we didn't see him die, and what if he's the champion? Mm-hmm. Because if you're considering champions of the faith, it's very poetic.
Yeah.
And that's what's telling is like, out of the hundreds of thousands of people listening to this podcast, no one bitched at me for spoiling the Clegane Bowl. So, like...
When? During the instant take?
Yeah, so...
Oh, well, it's no longer spoiler.
I know,
it's
but I was kind of braced for a smattering of I can't believe you spoiled... Because, and I was prepared to say, well, look, it's a theory. We don't know if it's true. These are the information that we're basing the theory on, and it's all out in the show now, so...
Yeah.
But no, so no one did. That was good.
Yeah.
And I think everybody wants it to happen, too.
I do, yeah.
But you're right. There are still a lot. I mean, it's very up in the air. Like, for example, we're in the Clegane Bowl part. Brad C. is going to outline the problems with eating all the chickens in the room. I'm having a hard time. By the way, like, I don't know about where you live, but, you know, most major grocery stores sell whole roasted chickens for like $5 or $6.
Mm-hmm.
You get a half dozen of those, have a party, eat all the chickens. That's what I'm planning on doing.
We're eating chicken live on the air.
Brad C. And also get a couple flagons of ale, because eating chickens is thirsty work.
From here on out, every episode I'm going to have a chicken at the ready while I'm watching the episode, just so I can eat it when it happens.
Sure, why not? Brad C. says, I'm having a hard time moving the pieces in my mind to get to the Clegane Bowl. A religious sect that the Hound was with doesn't seem affiliated with the religious sect that the High Sparrow runs in King's Landing. How does the High Sparrow even know they exist? Does he have anything? Does he know anything about the Hound? I didn't see any ravens there. Septon Maribold seems to be completely off the Faith's radar. I think it's more likely that he'll run into Brienne and have a plot line that takes him north and reunites him with his little bird Sansa. He could possibly run into Arya when she eventually gets back to Westeros. The fact that she, Arya, confessed to the Waif that she didn't wish him dead is more of a predictor to their reunion than him going to King's Landing and fighting for the Faith. All that being said, the Hound has always been my favorite character, and I'd love to see the Clegane Bowl, no matter how it comes about. So, there is a lot of problems with the Clegane Bowl, and I agree with this analysis. In the book, it's a little bit more, makes a little bit more sense, because... The Septon Maribold seems like he is an established, he's living on the Quiet Islands, and he's with a monastic order, and none of these guys speak, and mm-hmm. like this is like a big colony of the faith. But here in the show, I mean, that's the thing, in the books they leave it there, like Sandor, he's alive, but he's here and he's got peace, and he's got no hate in his heart, and he's become a new man, and... That was like halfway through this episode, and then they took it where I presume they're taking it in the books.
Hate.
hate.
So I think that could be the motivating factor here. I mean, if he just decides, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to once and for all kill my brother.
He volunteers. Like, I'm going to... First...
Well, he doesn't know that the mountain's dead, right?
Probably.
Like, he's been walking around and living a monastic lifestyle, half debatable. Dead. Like,
I would think that'd be hot topic of conversation and gossip, but whether it spread that far north, who knows?
But he was purposely trying to avoid people all throughout his journey with Arya. Like... He's been off the radar for a long time.
Yeah.
So I don't know if he even knows that he's dead. Now, he is angry.
Yes.
And he wants to go kill. First choice should probably be his brother. Get revenge.
Well, I mean, he's got to deal with the Brotherhood first. That's the... I mean, there's only 3 episodes left, and he has to confront the Brotherhood. He has to.
I guess so.
Because that's who he thinks has killed his people.
Now, but are they his people? Like, I don't know where he stands
definitely,
on them.
He definitely feels... if not a kinship, a responsibility for these people. That's why he wanted to defend them in the first place. There's no... And he's
I don't
got
know. He might
he's
also
got unfinished
feel that
business
idiots.
With the Brotherhood, too. Like, you know, he... The Does last he? Time... Well, I mean, he fought a fight to the death with the Beric Dondarrion. This is how him and Arya got out of there. Like, they tried him by combat. He beat Beric barely. Beric got brought back to life. And so, like, I feel like he thinks they're a bunch of cunts anyway.
Okay.
And
yeah,
now he thinks they've killed these people for no damn good reason. Because I think Sandor thinks these were all good people. Like, he might not see himself as that, but...
Yeah.
And the show took great pains to paint these as, like...
Oh, yeah.
Super good, unassuming, wholesome folk.
Right. I just don't know... Like, I didn't get a real strong connection between him and them. Like, I thought he was looking at them. You know, maybe Deadwood guy was, like, starting to crack his exterior.
You
but
really don't think he felt like he had an obligation to protect those people?
I felt like he was having that conversation about, like, you got to fight to protect certain things.
Yeah.
Trying to talk some sense into that guy, but I don't feel like he personally needed to fight for them. I just never got that.
I strongly disagree with that. Okay. But, so, anyway... we'll have to wait to see the last 3 episodes, but I thought you did a good job of showing the problems with the Clegane Bowl theory there, Brad. Yeah. He also has a point. Would it be too much of a reach for Gendry being in Braavos and being the one who helps Arya and her stabbed up gut? I think it's more than likely than Cyrio Forel coming back from season 1, Obscurity to save the day. Although if I was in Vegas and betting money, I'd say that what really happens is Lady Crane finds her on the verge of death and repays the favor by saving her life. Assuming that Arya gets stabbed in the gut, which is a big assumption, what do you think about Gendry? Comes rowing in to town.
I mean, he's just as out of nowhere as Cyrio
sure.
is at this point. Like,
I mean, not quite, but just about.
Right, because we know that he's... Well, we assume he's probably not dead. He wasn't in mortal peril the last time we saw him.
Sure.
But I don't know. I'm still operating under the idea that that is not actually Arya.
Okay.
So Arya cannot be saved by anybody because she's not in that kind of danger.
What do you think about Lady Crane?
What about her? Like, her, coming to nurse the fake Arya to health?
Or the real Arya, if you want to go.
You're not
even
going
to entertain those type of theories?
I don't think it's the real Arya.
Okay, I don't either. But
okay,
Lady Crane's involvement wouldn't surprise me, because they gave her a lot of screen time for... I mean, it could just be this. That's an important decision that Arya had to make. But
right.
You know, anytime I see someone that talented with that much screen time, I think maybe there's more to their story.
Hmm. What about the parallel of, like, someone from the seven god religion, seven pointed star religion coming in and helping her, like Sandor had?
It's not really a Braavos thing.
Yeah.
But
is Cyrio or Gendry. So.
Well, Braavos is very much a Braavos. I mean, Cyrio very much is a Braavos thing. He was the first sort of Braavos, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, but he's nowhere near the last time we see him.
Okay. I do think that there is a connection between Arya and Hound, and they visually made it, so there's more to their story in a together kind of thing, but we'll have to see where it goes.
Right.
Graham H. says, so far this season has brought back 3 characters from the quote-unquote dead, Jon, Benjen, and the Hound. As cool as it is to see them all again, do you think the Double Ds are being a little too generous with these resurrections? Maybe we're in for some major Red Wedding-level shit to go down. That is a concern. Anytime you bring people back from the dead and play fast and loose with who's dead and who's alive, you run the risk of fatigue. And I wouldn't say it's the Double Ds doing this. I would say it's George Martin doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Because... Every one of these, well, except for Benjen, is straight out of the book, or what we think is going to happen in the book. So, it's definitely a concern. They haven't reached that point to meet for me. I wonder how many more resurrections we'd go through before I would get there. I feel like we're almost at the limit.
Yeah.
My tilt sensor's about to go off.
Definitely stretching it for me, especially when you mix in so much magic. I mean, faceless men, sure, and time travel and like actual straight up blood magic. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of stuff, a lot of shenanigans that could go on completely just hand waved away by magic.
And that's the two sides of the story. Number one, they're playing it fair because these are all tools in this universe.
Right.
But on the other hand, that's not the show we started watching. So
right.
If you, yes, that's why we're all going along with it. But there is a certain point where people are like, you know what? Fuck it. Like, why not bring Ned back now?
Yeah.
Someone found a bone fragment and poured and pricked her finger. And
he's got a line of stitches around his neck, but yeah, he's pretty much the same old Ned.
Yeah. Like,
he warged into Temeria, sure, who was in the forest. Like,
sure.
Why not?
Shit, man. Get on Reddit with that. You can probably get a couple hundred upvotes.
Right.
And
you notice when I talk about these things, I do a little bit of eye rolling,
uh-huh,
when it comes to the magic. Because like you said,
this isn't your scene, man. Fantasy's not your
It's not my scene, and I guess, you know, I had always heard that Game of Thrones was fantasy for people who don't like fantasy.
Yeah.
And I got involved in the show from that perspective, thinking, okay, this is super interesting from the political angles, from the character, right, motivations, from the military angles. I really love all that stuff. When you
and
start mixing
is.
In so... And those are the things that I get excited about.
Sure.
Jaime marching his guys up to,
sure,
this fucking castle,
yeah,
to strong-arm the Blackfish, to kill him. Those are the things that I love about it. And when you mix in so much magic, it does diminish my enjoyment of certain aspects. But that's just me. Other people love that shit. So,
yes.
I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's not for me.
Yeah. Andy B says, this is the downside to everyone coming back from the dead, because you get people speculating like this. We didn't get to see the Hound expire on screen, and here he is hobbling around the Shire.
Mm-hmm.
Who else have we not seen meet their bloody end on screen?
Syrio.
Stannis. Stanny B is coming back. Further both Sandor
and
Stannis.
Come on, Brienne said she killed him.
Further both Sandor and Stannis' final fight was against Brienne of Tarth, who also said the Hound was dead, didn't she? In her attempt to fulfill her oath. Fighting Brienne and not dying gives you a second chance to finally do the right thing.
Okay, there's a difference. If Brienne tells you, look, I think the guy's dead because he fell off a cliff.
Right.
Versus, I beheaded this motherfucker with my sword and my two hands.
Yeah.
There's a huge difference.
And I got Andy, I was right on with you last season, because I was like, well, we didn't see him die, and Brienne maybe could do something interesting with her. But when she shows up saying, I killed Stannis,
I mean, here, I'll throw him a bone. In the end, he's right. Like, you know.
You don't know.
We just don't know. Yeah. Brienne could be, like, lying about that. I guess. I don't know why she would, though.
All right. Let's move on then to where I have lost my point. Doug L. giving us odds on Arya. First possibility, she dies. I give it 50-1. This is Game of Thrones and Valor Morghulis. But if she's going to die, her death will likely further the plot in some larger, meaningful way. Dying alone in the streets of Braavos is quite the literal dead end, unless the Faceless Men have some designs on using her face for something important. I agree. Long odds on Arya being dead.
Yeah.
Cyrha Forel saves her, 30-1. What do we say to the god of death? Not today. Hearing those words come to fruition would be badass, and Cyrio is a Braavosi, but the show would have to bend over backwards to explain where he's been and how he knew where she was, and that's a tall order. He was jacking the whole time. He's always been jacking.
Right.
End of story. she saves herself, 10-1. Arya has failed a lot along the way, especially this week, but we do have her, but we have to have her back entirely. Wait. Let me start over. But to have her be entirely rescued by someone else robs her of some agency. We need to see her kick ass again. That said, the giant hole in her belly needs some serious help, and while she may know some combat, it's not clear she knows anything about triage. Plus, these particular wounds in this particular historical setting are almost universally fatal. Like, this isn't a broken bone.
Right.
This is like... Your intestines are probably sliced up. You got sepsis starting to set in. Like, I don't see how you get away. You're also rolling around in a fucking canal. God knows what kind of flesh-eating bacteria is up in there.
I would have said the same about Sandor, though. his wounds look to me to be completely fatal in this universe, especially since he's hanging out in the middle of nowhere with no help to be
found.
You
think he'd at least lose his leg, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I mean, compound fractures, bad news without antibiotics.
Right.
Lady Crane saves her, 5-1 odds. Good karma pays off after Arya spares her life. This certainly tracks, and it might be interesting to see Arya travel with mummers and learn their tricks. After all, Varys uses them to good effect, as well as potentially perform in a play about Westerosi politics. That'd be interesting, but I wonder if we have that much time to have her do like a crowd-pleasing tour turn as some person in a fart and slap.
I really want her to be more badass. Like, I feel like her training wouldn't have been useful for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it she'd be falling short of her potential, I guess.
Okay. 5-1, Jaqen saves her. Technically, the way failed. Does this mean she gets access to Arya, who manages to survive? Is this all part of a larger test? Jim, where would you put the odds on this isn't Arya?
1 to 10.
I thought you were going to be 1 to 1. What?
1 to 10.
That means
10 to 1. This is Arya.
Okay, I was going to say that's not how odds work, man.
No, but he was progressively going down. I'm okay. Going the opposite
so
direction.
You're saying 10 to 1.
1 to 10 that this Arya. Is.
So you think you think Jaqen saving her, which I believe Jaqen can heal any wound he needs to heal. Like I feel like the Faceless Men could do some kind of weird ass magic and she'd be just fine. So you think it's less likely?
I think it's less likely for her to die than this.
What about Lady Crane saving her? You think it's more likely that happens and this isn't Arya? Because he gave that 5-1 odds.
No, I mean, I'm operating under whatever odds he gave to anything, this is more certain in my mind that this is not Arya.
Sarah wrote in with some interesting points from an Entertainment Weekly article from an interview with Brian Cogman, who is the director for this episode, because we talked about jetpacks and timelines and we kind of wondered about it, but it seemed like he made it explicit. Entertainment Weekly said, it feels like we're jumping between storylines and we have that vastly different lengths of time passing between each scene. Do you care to comment on this? And Brian said, the timelines between the various storylines don't necessarily line up with a given episode.
Yeah.
For instance, the northern tour that Jon and Sansa embark on this episode would probably take a couple of weeks, but Arya's storyline over the past few episodes only spans a few days. We realized long ago that if we tied ourselves in knots trying to make all the story days line up between all episodes, the momentum would suffer.
Yeah, this is so obvious.
Yes.
I don't even know why people are asking about this in interviews. This is the basic thing of the visual style of this show.
Yeah, and also it tracks well with the books where the passage of time is not consistent between POV and POV.
Right.
Because you're right, it's like it's very impossible to tell one story where there's a lot going on. If you just did in chronological order, it might be months before you see Arya again.
Sure. I mean, even if it wasn't impossible, it's just, I think, more interesting.
It's a good editorial choice.
Yeah.
Sarah continues, one question out of this episode, where is Melisandre? She is riding with Sansa and Jon when they left Castle Black, but no sign of her since.
Ah, good question.
Even when they returned to the camp where I believe she burned Princess Shireen. Davos was discussing the snows, the Jon and Sansa, which definitely echo back to Stannis' worst moment, and yet no mention or sight of Mel. Mm-hmm. Seems like a notable omission. I didn't even realize that until I got this email. Like
that was the same site?
No. Well, I did realize that, but like the fact that Melisandre is absent is hugely noticeable now that you lay it out like that.
Right.
So what does that mean?
You think there's any possibility she's on like the search for the Brotherhood?
I mean, we have no information. I mean, it's like, it's not like she's like, hey, I want to peace out and do something else while you're doing this. Like, literally.
Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah. That would make sense if she goes back and like, hey, I brought someone back from the dead. You want to compare notes? Like,
and maybe help us out?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
That sort of thing.
But it would have been, part of me would be pissed that they didn't show, like, that would have been an easy thing for them to establish as they're riding forth the gates. We're going to do this. Well, my lord, I'm going to do that because she pledges to Jon and says she's going to follow him, and now she's gone.
I would almost say, like, she's just sort of faded into the background and they don't need her in the moment. But they made a point of, like, her commenting a couple episodes.
It doesn't feel like something she would just slink back. I mean, we talked about that. Like, it feels like she'd be ascendant after she brings back Jon, and she seems to be backgrounded. So.
And she's adjusted her prophecy, and we know that she's following the new prince who she thinks is Jon. Why would she leave unless she's out there going to get troops, maybe.
Katie M says, I've never written in before, but Lady Olenna is the real people's champion for saying everything that everyone has thought about Cersei for years. Yep. She is a bad bitch.
Yep.
Side note, apparently by the inverse property, the further Jaime gets away from Cersei, the hotter he gets.
Okay.
Cannot disagree with that.
Yeah, that armor is doing him some favors.
Heck Tate wrote in and says, could Brienne's arrival at the Siege of Riverrun propose a three-way bargain that goes something like this? One, Jaime and Bronn into Blackfish take the 8,000 Lannister forces north to Winterfell to free the castle and save half of the Stark children, Jon, Sansa, and Rickon. Two, the Tully army remains inside Riverrun to keep the Freys out, but the Blackfish returns from a freed Winterfell and agrees to admit Edmure as the Lord of Riverrun, which fucks Walder Frey out of Riverrun. But in return, Edmure swears fealty to King Tommen. There's no way for the Blackfish to come to the aid of the Starkkin without ending or suspending the siege, and there's no way Jaime will end the siege without some manner of saving face for Tommen. There's a good argument to be made for the Tullys, who are better allies than the Freys for the Lannisters, since the Freys are generally only relevant to the Northern strategy anyway, whereas Jaime's main concern is still King's Landing and not Dorne. Sure, he'd be disobeying orders, but does he care at this point?
You lost me in there. That thing pretzeled in on itself in a way that I didn't
my thing
pick up
is
on.
Like. So there's two ways to look at this. Number one, this is a bad deal for both parties. This is giving up a lot of this is the, you know, the enemies of the Lannisters swearing fealty. And it's also the Lannisters rearming and re-strengthening their mortal foe, the Starks. On the other hand, you could say, well, that's a hell of a compromise. If both parties think they're getting completely fucked by it, then it might be a good compromise. But I don't.
Okay.
I don't know, man. It doesn't seem like either one would agree to this. But it's an interesting thought. Like, you know, if you just from a wheeling and dealing aspect, it seems like the chits are equal across the table, but I just don't think any of them would consent to any of this stuff. Anything you want to comment on?
Nope.
All right. Matt C. says, is every lord a knight, but not every knight is a lord? He's trying to figure out Westerosi politics.
You have to have a keep? To be a lord?
Yeah, my keep is to be a lord, you have to be have lands and or titles.
Right.
Now, a knight is a title. It's the very lowest level title, but mm-hmm. you can be a knight and not have a keep. They call those hedge knights.
Right.
Because they sleep underneath hedges. And also, it's a historical oddity. Very few northern men are knights, because to be a knight, you have to be anointed by the Faith of the Seven. So it's it's kind of a religious title as well as a military one.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. So, like, you know, it's kind of like knighting someone in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. They do that with the Seven. So a lot of Northerners just don't give a shit about being knights.
Okay, that makes sense.
So, yeah, I think you got the right. It's I don't know that every lord, because a lot of Northern lords wouldn't be knights, but probably most of them at some point were knighted. But you're right, not every knight's a lord. That's as plain as I can make it. Let's move on to Kevin B. He said, you touched on this in Instant Cast, and I agree that I can't believe that the Brotherhood without Banners would slaughter the Septon and all those innocent people who are doing the barn raising with the Hound. I think they're building a sept, if I was to guess, but barn, sure, whatever. I predict
they were very sort of Amish in their demeanor and their methods. Yeah.
Yep. I was wanting to count how many sides that thing's had, but if it had seven, it's surely a sept. I predict it will be revealed that the act was designed to bring the Hound out of his peaceful exile to be the Faith's champion in the Clegane Bowl by none other than the High Septon himself. To kill all those people for refusing to pay protection money is more Tony Soprano than Beric Dondarrion. The Brotherhood's stated purpose, at least in the books, is to protect the small folk, and these were some of the smallest folk we've seen. Mm-hmm. I think the Hound is being manipulated in returning to a life of violence. It makes narrative sense for the High Sparrow to be the one pulling the strings. He needs a champion in Cersei's trial by combat that would show him to be the real hypocrite we all know and want him to be. The only problem with the theory is how to explain the High Sparrow knowing the Hound is there. But I assume he's got spies like everyone else with power in King's Landing. That's the rub with this whole thing. How does the High Septon know about the Hound to take notice of him?
Right, and maybe there's a little bias in my desire to see a Clegane Bowl, but
sure.
I feel like it's a little. It just feels right that the High Septon is behind this. It's a little out of character, I think, for him to go killing people who presumably haven't done anything. in order to accomplish that mission. That seems like a sin to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know why how he could authorize that in good conscience. Then again, I think he's a sack of shit who's full of a lot of dog shit. Yeah.
Oh, that's a sack of dog shit.
A sack
even
of
worse.
Dog shit that's about to be stepped on.
There you go. That involves the hound, Cleganebowl confirmed.
Set on fire and stepped on.
I have a hard time saying Cleganebowl. Mm-hmm. It gets all nasally.
In the clip I use, you actually transpose the E and the L.
God.
Which I love.
I gotta say Kelgane?
No, I think it's like maybe it's the G and the L. It's Cleganebowl or something like that.
Oh, well.
I love it.
Again, I was sick when we recorded that clip.
That's true.
Gretel B. Oh, wait. Well, before I get to that, Dan from Washington. A lot of people have sent this in over the weeks. So I finally decided to tackle it. In the season 2 finale, when Arya, Gendry, and Hot Pie come across Jaqen and he helps him escape, Jaqen tells Arya to come with her to become a faceless man and says the following: a girl has many names on her lips. Joffrey, Cersei, Tywin Lannister, Illyn Payne, the Hound. Names to offer up to the Red God. She could offer them all, one by one. Doesn't it seem like everything Jaqen has said and done since Arya arrived in Braavos has been a complete contradiction of his initial sales pitch of the Faceless Men lifetime membership? My response is, he would not be the first quasi-military recruiter to promise someone...
Right.
Join, see the world, get your college scholarships paid for, you promise a lot until you get them on the boats or you get them in basic and then they realize they've given up all their rights as people and then they got to do whatever you tell them to do.
Yeah.
So recruiters, that's kind of historical fact that they sell you the glories of war and they don't talk about the peeling the potatoes and the dying in cold pools of mud. So
yeah,
it could be that he's just lying to her.
Yeah.
The other theory is that somehow Arya is special with a capital S. That, like, they've got their own version of the princess that was promised or whatever, and that Jaqen's got that he's got something in mind for her to do grander than just being merely a faceless man.
Could be.
But who knows? Gretel B. We're going to end with some hype slaying here. Cleganebowl has been floated around for years, and it's picking up steam with both characters back on screen. However, everything on screen suggests that Cleganebowl is dead. The Hound is borderline crippled with his leg injury. He's still big and strong, but nowhere near the fighter he was. The Mountain is undead, and Qyburn suggests he's stronger than ever. Follow that to its natural conclusion. The show has made the Hound's injury more explicit than the books, and in the process has nearly killed any excitement over a potential trial by combat.
Let me stop you.
It's a huge stretch to get the Hound back into King's Landing, and it's nonsensical to think he stands a chance against his brother. Get hyped, get real.
Let's get real for a second. Uh-huh. Why do you... That email is assuming that the Hound is going to beat the Mountain.
Ah.
Cleganebowl can happen and the Hound can get fucking killed.
True. That would... like... That would be very unsatisfying.
Oh, yeah. But come on.
If
so
that's
the
Cleganebowl
Red Wedding,
I'm
so
getting, I'd rather not... It's like, if someone told you your team's going to be in the Super Bowl, but they're going to get destroyed, like Patriots versus Bears style, you might say, well, fuck it. I'd rather honk out in the first round.
Right.
Like, yeah, the trip to the Big Bowl only is awesome. Like, I almost would rather not have the Cleganebowl if Sandor dies in it.
There's a history of this. Oberyn was badass.
Sure,
we wanted him to
sure.
beat the Mountain. He got his head crushed in.
Sure.
Come on. There's nothing that says he's got to win. It can still happen.
Yeah, they're true. That is very
true. Some other fine points in there about, you know, the road seems pretty...
I think people are overplaying his physical injury. I feel like that he did lift an entire fucking tree trunk by himself.
He did.
And
he walked it a good
ways. You know, when the Mountain and the Hound went at each other in the Prime during the Tournament of the Hand in the first season, I felt like the Hound might have gotten the better out of the Mountain. Because the Mountain was insanely angry and was not in his right head. And... like, I don't feel like being a zombie has improved any of those aspects of Gregor.
And it might have improved his strength, but what about his mobility? Because that's what you're really arguing with the Hound, too.
And what about his wits? Like, you know,
right.
Clearly the Mountain was stronger than Oberyn, but Oberyn was a smarter fighter, and he used his abilities better. He used his reach and his poison-tipped spear and all those things.
Sure. And I feel bad, a little bad, you know, shooting it down without... her here to argue her point about
mobility.
Well,
Gretel did not feel
or...
any bad at all for slaying hype, so...
That's true.
Man, so... woman, child, I don't care. Like, you're a hype slayer.
Yep.
I dub thee hype slayer. banding words with a hype slayer is like building a podcast on quicksand.
Yeah.
And with that, we sink into the muck because that's the last piece of feedback. Okay. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com. If you want to get in feedback, we still got the Friday show, and we'll probably have a little bit bigger of a mailbag to catch up any points we didn't miss or we did miss on this week, this to start off next week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, Friday for the spoiler edition. We'll be back Sunday for the next episode, which I'm sure is going to be rad.
Can't wait.
I can't. Like, these next
Judging
three episodes.
Judging by the preview, oh my God.
These next three episodes are going to be a roller coaster.
Yeah.
This season has been a return to form.
I agree. Yeah, a lot of people didn't like last season. This season, I think...
I was nervous for this season, but they have really, really delighted me.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff I was set up to intrinsically, like, to just really dislike
yes.
with this High Septon business and yes. stuff, but I think it's played out pretty good.
Indeed.
I'm excited.
All right, that's it. We will see you in a couple days.
All right, see you then.
Bye.